you go there, and after you do, all of these dreams would be yours to pursue the rest of your lifetime, devoid of a care. If you keep your eyes open, you may find yourself there. Such is the promise, such is the curse. You could just live your life, better or worse, knowing the cache of dreams up on that hill beckons and sways but won't bend to your will. You might find a river though, under a mountain that feeds a remote subterranean fountain. Drink from this taste, just a hint of a dream that somehow leaked in through the underground stream. And if you go there, and after you do, all of these dreams would be yours to pursue the rest of your lifetime, devoid of a care. If you keep your eyes open, you may find yourself there.
Didn't Hi, everybody. We are live. So if you want to, like, really screw anything up big time, like, really, if you want to just really make some of the biggest public mistakes of your life, now is the time to do it, because at least we're not the OpenAI board.
You're jumping ahead, my friend. Jumping ahead.
Yes. Oh, my God. Like, this. Wow. I mean, you know, you talk about people having bad weeks. Like, sometimes, oh, yeah, they're having a bad week. Boy, are they having a bad week.
At least it's relatively low stakes. I feel like it's fun because it's only like whatever $80 billion on the line. But it's, you know, in the end, it's people with computers and stuff and things. And it's not like life or death. And most of the people involved, you feel OK laughing at them a little bit because they're such big, distant figures. They don't seem like real people to you. But rest assured, they are. And that's probably why they're in this mess.
Indeed, it is a disaster. But you know what is not a disaster? It is the final warning. Final warning. I wish I had like a klaxon, which granted most of the house is asleep.
Marco will insert the final
countdown. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Diddle-doo-doo. So really, this is it. This is your final warning. This is the moment where you, a dear beloved listener who has not yet put in your order, you sit or stand there and you think, I've got this. No worries. I'm going to take care of that as soon as I get to the office, or I'll take care of it as soon as I get home. And then you, dear beloved listener, you forget. And then what happens? Then the rules state you have to go tweeting, even though I won't see it, or tooting at me saying, I'm the one. I'm that person this time. Don't be that person. Don't do that to yourself. Go to atp.fm/store. This is your final warning. This is all we got. This is it. The sale ends this weekend, Sunday, November 26th. That's it. That's all the time you get. So go now. Don't hesitate. Pull over the car. Use a signal because you're an adult and courteous. Use a signal. If you're walking, do what you need to do to indicate to those behind you. You will be pulling to the side of the sidewalk. If you're biking, God help you, but do what you got to do with as a bikist, as Marco would say, to get to the side of the road and not get run over by a car.
That makes people so mad, by the way.
I know it does. I'm just
they
messing.
Don't get that it's a joke. Like it makes them so mad.
I know. We know that bikist is not a thing. Anyways, all kidding aside, go to atp.fm/store. Check out our merch. Check out our wares. And remember, if you are a member, you get 15% off the ATP store during this time limited sale and all other time limited sales. Now is the time. I know we kind of glossed over it last week, but John, would you mind just doing a brief overview of everything just one last time to really sell it, just nail it and send it home? Let's get a few more sales, John. What do we have on offer?
We're not going to go through all the merch again. They know what's there. People know.
I'll go through all the merch. So many pooper. I'll do a speed run. We got ATP Pixels. We've got ATP Space Black. We've got the M3 shirt, the M3 Pro shirt, the M3 Max shirt. We've got ATP Six Colors, which is six colors of fabric, actually more than six colors of fabric, but the text is always white. Really should have workshopped that name, but here we are. ATP logo shirt, the OG. We've got the ATP hoodie, ATP polo. Don't let me down, polo ponies, polo people. Don't let me down. This is my jam. Get an ATP polo, please, and thank you. We've also got the ATP mug in now, white and a bluey, purpley sort of thing. John will correct me.
It's cobalt, please, Casey.
Thank you. Of course, I said that. It's definitely cobalt. Definitely not
recycled cobalt. Don't worry.
Uh-huh, sure. And the ATP pint glass. So go now, atp.fm/store. And remember, if you're a member, go to your member page, landing strip, whatever you call it thing, and go get your bespoke discount code for 15% off, atp.fm/store. This is it, people. 26, that's all you got.
The only thing I'll add is remember that a lot of the products come in long sleeve t-shirt versions and sweatshirt versions. I think this is kind of the first time we've done those in a lot of these products. So check, even though a lot of times it will show a picture of a t-shirt, if you watch long enough, the picture will rotate and you'll see some long sleeve varieties. And it's, you know, the cold winter months in our parts anyway. So think about those long sleeve options if you're interested. And this sale does span Black Friday. We did this intentionally. So it ends on the 26th. Black Friday is a couple days before that. You're going to be thinking about shopping for the holidays, probably. Or you'll be bombarded by messages about shopping for the holidays. Don't forget, this is your last chance. I know we do the sale kind of early, but we're trying as best we can to have a chance of getting these things to you in time for the holidays. So, you know, nerdy gifts for yourself or for others. Don't forget, when Black Friday arrives, that's another reminder for you to hear Casey's voice in your head is saying, oh, wait, was I supposed to buy some nerd thing? Yes, atp.fm/store.
Indeed. There's also Ute sizes as well, which we added a little bit late. Apologies about that. So you can check out for your kids. You can get them stuff for friends, kids, you know, whatever you want to do. atp.fm/store. I'm telling you, this is good stuff. You should definitely check it out. And time's running out, my friends. Time is running out. I feel like I had something else I wanted to add, but I forgot what it was. So that's all right. We'll make me sound smart in post, right, Marco? Right. Okay, good. Let's do some follow up. Let's talk about keyboard. Oh, brutal. Brutal. Well played, but very mean. Keyboardware. Let's talk about. God, you really derailed me with that. Keyboardware. Let's talk about what happens to keyboards because of your damn dirty fingers. Ryan Holmes writes, Casey, I think what you're seeing as finger grease is likely what keyboard enthusiasts call quote unquote shine that happens to ABS plastic. It's relatively soft plastic that is susceptible to finger oils and heat. To John's point, some people's finger oils shine them more than others. When you use a magic eraser to remove the shine, you are literally abrading off a layer of plastic. Okay, so interrupting briefly, I don't debate that that's very possibly true, but I'm not like sawing the keyboard with a magic eraser. Like just a quick glance with it is more than enough, and I only do this a handful of times a year. Like I think like,
that is true though. Like that is how the abrasive and a magic eraser works.
No,
you are
it.
Taking the layer off. It's just a very small layer because it's a very fine.
But you're
eraser.
Also leaving bits of the magic eraser on your keyboard and going down into the. I'm still against the magic eraser.
Yeah, it's not a great option to have to use. Ideally, you don't need it. That like because you're right. There is some risk of, like, you know, getting little dots of it stuck in there and jamming up the keys. Obviously, now that we have a little more robust keyboards than we used to, that risk is lower, but it is still a risk. So, yeah, you are better off doing that if you can help it.
That's fair. Continuing back to what Ryan Holmes was writing, ABS is nice for keycaps because they are easy to double shot, meaning the letters can be embedded into the key and won't wear off. It's a separate layer of plastic molded inside. This also enables any color combo. A more durable option is PBT, polybutylene, terephthalate, which takes much higher temperatures to deform. It does not quote unquote shine. It often has a deeper sound and can be double shot, but double shotting it is not common and can involve a blend with ABS. The more common way to print legends on PBT is dye sublimation, which involves heat and dye. The dye embeds into the top layer of the key, so the legends will essentially never wear off. There is so much lingo here. My word. I know every like interest and profession has their own vocabulary, but my gosh. Anyways, it's difficult to get them as crisp as double shot, however, and they will not let LEDs glow through. PBT is also difficult for light legends on dark caps, since the whole cap will need to be dyed except the legend, which is masked out. This amount of dyeing involves longer exposure of the plastic to heat and often deforms larger keys, most notably space bars. Cheaper OEM keyboards use other kinds of surface printing that wears off relatively easily. So that was way more information than certainly I needed or wanted to know about.
Some background on Apple's keyboards. Like, so Apple's using ABS, which is the softer plastic. Apple has used PBT in the past on older laptops. Before your time, but back in the day, the PowerBooks used to come with keyboards that it was kind of hilarious. They look kind of like, you've all seen the Apple Extended 2, right? Even if you've never actually touched one, like what those keycaps look like. Imagine those, but imagine you took them into a 3D program and you squished them so they're not as high. Right. And that's what they made the PowerBook keycaps look like. From the top, it looked like, oh, that's just a regular key. But then you'd look from the side and you'd see they were squished down. Like they had the same kind of like slanted edges, but just much, much smaller. I'm pretty sure though, back in those days, the keycaps were PBT. Of course, they weren't backlit. So that's the whole big thing. I think all of Apple's keyboards now on their laptops are backlit. You can't backlit like the PBT because it doesn't let light through it. That's why they were talking about having ABS mixed in, because you could let the light go through the ABS part, like just the letter that's on them or whatever. But anyway, Apple's keycaps on all their modern keyboards all appear to be the very much softer ABS.
Anonymous writes, the backlit keyboard keycaps on Apple laptops are injection molded in clear plastic. You know, I'm going to do that again because I accidentally touched the mic just to be safe. Hi, future Marco.
Hello.
Anonymous writes, the backlit keyboard keycaps on Apple laptops are injection molded in clear plastic. They are painted with white paint, then black paint. The glyphs are then laser etched using a method that removes the black paint, but not the white paint. Lastly, a protective clear coat is applied. Andrew writes, your conversation about wear on keyboards reminded me of a recent article by a British cycling journalist. Would that be a bikist, Marco? Is that correct? A bikist journalist.
A bike journalist, or yeah, I guess a bikist journalist. Yeah,
I guess that is a bikist. A bike yeah. journalist is indeed a bikist. There you go. We figured it
a
out.
A bikalist.
Oh my. We're going to get so much hate mail. On the recent demise of his 10-year-old MacBook, which had survived an impressive amount of abuse, you might like to see how worn his most used keys were. We will put a link in the show notes, and maybe Marco will make this chapter art. Maybe. let me tell you, actually, you know what? I would not advise you to make this chapter art because this keyboard is freaking horrifying.
Yeah.
Not only is this the ridiculous Tetris key return key, which I know the British people love, leaving that monstrosity aside, this is an abomination. Look, this is disgusting. This thing, it's I can't handle it. I need to scroll down because
this is one of many photos that we got. This is the worst one, obviously, but it's one of many, many, many photos that we got. Most of which were not 10 years old, to be clear. Most of which were much younger laptops. And if you to visualize what this picture looks like, picture an Apple keyboard with all of its black keycaps and then have little circles worn through them at various places, seeing the mechanism beneath, because as the earlier feedback item said, Apple's keys are made from clear plastic, and then they have black paint and white paint over them. And so this imagine the keys with the black and white paint rubbed off, just showing you the clear plastic. It's like there's little window panes of various sizes, and you can see where they wore through the black first and then the white second, right? And you see kind of like a terrace pattern where it's like black, then there's a white ring, and then there's a clear spot. And you can tell where this person hit the space bar. Like they hit it in one very specific spot all the time. Tons of people had this. And, you know, again, the leading theory is pH levels of either more acidic or more basic, sweat from their fingers or whatever, essentially wearing through the paint because these are painted clear plastic. And if they were PBT, where it was the color of the plastic instead of being painted, this wouldn't happen. But then you couldn't have the backlights unless you double shot them. But then there's the, you know, there's thing like to put the dye on the entire key of something, a long key like the space bar might warp. So I would say, like as we mentioned in the last show, keyboard durability on laptops, aesthetic durability, not like, you know, making the keys continue to work, still seems like an area where Apple could use some improvement. I think what they have now is a reasonable-ish compromise because they're lightweight, they're fairly sturdy, they hold up pretty well most of the time. But if you're one of those people who wears away keycaps, it's a bummer for you because you're going to have a worse experience with this keyboard. It'll be nice if the keys still work. And I guess as long as you remember what those letters were before you wore them off with your fingers, you're fine. So functionality is job one, but aesthetics should be somewhere in the top five. And the current keyboards are failing that for some subset of Apple's customers.
This next section is John tries to make Casey feel bad about liking 14-inch laptops. So I'm just going to go
just
take
John.
A...
I mean, if only one of us would have said last episode, you know, with this amount of power draw, so much increase from the M1 generation, maybe the 14-inch might be a bad idea if you get the Max chip, because it seems like that's a lot of heat for the 14-inch to quietly and gracefully get rid of compared to the 16-inch. So, John, what happened?
Mm-hmm, I mean, to be clear, this was true of the M2 and M1 generations as well, which is why Marco gave that advice. But anyway, we'll put a link in the show notes to a YouTube video where they tested the M3 Max 14-inch versus 16-inch. And I think I said in the last show that, like, well, you know, maybe the cooling should be roughly equivalent. And the thing that is stuck on top of the M3 Max, like the little whatever heat spreader thing that's pulling the heat off, yeah, that part's the same. Every other part of it is not the same, though. First of all, the heat pipe itself that's leading away from the SoC, that heat pipe is wider on the 16-inch. So right away, there's a difference in the cooling system. But the big difference is the fans in the 16-inch are so much bigger than the fans in the 14-inch. Like, they're really using that extra space to good effect. It is a dramatic difference in the size of the fans and obviously the amount of air they can move. And then the fans are blowing that air over, these little fin things that are attached to the heat pipe, and there's more of them. Anyway, in the testing, two big things came out. First, that 14-inch is going to run the fans at much higher RPM. So they did like a Cinebench benchmark, and the 14-inch was running the fans at 7,200 RPM and the 16-inch at 3,800. So it was like double the fan speed. And obviously, if the fans are running faster, they're going to be noisier. And since the 14-inch fans are smaller, they're going to be a little bit more annoying, too, because they're higher pitched. That's not great. The stabilized fan speed. I love when they fancy up their benchmarks here. So the average speed in the Cinebench 2024 GPU test was 7,200 RPMs for the 14-inch, 1,700 RPM for the 16-inch. That's a big difference. That's as in, like, you can hear the fan screaming the entire time in the 14-inch, and on the 16-inch, you probably wouldn't hear anything. And now Casey may be saying, I don't care about that. I don't run 3D benchmarks. I don't care about the average fan speed over a 10-minute run of some type of thing. But then they did an Xcode test, and that's really, really hitting Casey where it hurts, because that's the thing that he does do. And this is not about the fan speed or about temperatures or anything like that. This is the fact that all those things with the fan being higher on the 14-inch translate to the 14-inch being in more thermal distress. And thermal distress means thermal throttling. And so this is where the rubber meets the road. The 14-inch is a little bit slower than the 16-inch because it thermal throttles when doing Xcode compiles. Now, this is probably a big Xcode compile. Maybe it's bigger than any of Casey's apps. Maybe it doesn't affect him or whatever. And yeah, the difference isn't huge.
It took like almost a minute and a half to do this compile. So like if you're doing a very long sustained CPU or GPU drain, you're gonna hit throttling on the 14-inch, no question. Like that's what this is clearly showing. Like if you are pegging the CPU or GPU for, you know, a minute or more, you are almost certainly going to see throttling on the 14-inch that is not present on the 16-inch.
Yeah, and the Xcode benchmark was 82 seconds on the 14-inch and 72 on the 16-inch. So not a huge difference. Not like the fan speed difference. I feel like the big quality of life difference is the fan speeds. Like,
I mean, that's like an M2 to M3 difference in performance, though. Like, but again, like this is a long sustained one. Like, you know, if you know my build takes 11 seconds, like it's probably in that span, I probably wouldn't see the difference between a 14 and a 16. But if you're doing builds that take a minute, you probably will.
Yeah. So, I mean, as the case with all these laptops, right, it's just a question of how much the cooling system can fight off the inevitable heat saturation due to long range jobs. It's rare that a laptop, a very high powered, top of the line, stuffed to the gills laptop, can sustain its full power for a very long period of time because the cooling systems usually aren't adequate to get all that heat out of there to keep up with it. Especially if you have some contrived, like, CPU maxed out at the same time as GPU maxed out, at the same time as neural engine maxed out, at the same time as the video encoder maxed out. Like, they're not going to be able to deal with that. But almost no real job is like that. That's why the GPU benchmark is so brutal here, because this was just a benchmark of the GPU, and the fan speeds were 7,000 RPM versus 1,700. That's not even close. That's just, they don't, stressing the GPU is enough to really, really see a difference. And that's relevant to people playing games. If you're going to play games on your laptop, you're like, I want these M series laptops. I don't need to hear the fans screaming when I play games. Get a 16-inch. You have a fighting chance of making that real, because if you want to find something that's going to really stress the GPU, yeah, playing a game for a long period of time will do it. I don't think this means that Casey should get a 16-inch. I think the 16-inch is too big as well. I think the whole point of being portable is to have something small. But if you are concerned about sustained performance, A, don't get a laptop. But B,
the 16-inch sustains it just fine. But for the
16-inch, the 16-inch eventually heat soaks as well, especially if you do a CPU plus GPU combo. These benchmarks are a little bit shorter. Yeah, and also the other thing they were measuring, which isn't any of these graphs in the show notes here, is clock speed. Like, they're just seeing, like, are they hitting their rated top clock speed? And both of these laptops, occasionally, depending on the benchmark, would never actually achieve their rated top benchmark, clock speed, or would do it very briefly in the beginning of the test and then never see it again, right? So there's always room for improvement, right? 16-inch versus 14 doesn't mean the 16-inch never thermal throttles. It just means it does it less than the 14, which is why it's coming out ahead in these tests.
Well, I would say these tests prove my hunch last week that if you're going for the max chip, maybe don't get the 14-inch. Like, if you're getting the 14-inch for like a all-around balance of portability and size, and maybe you're going for the M3 Pro chip, that's a different story. It can probably handle that a lot better. But if you're getting the M3 Max and you intend to push it at all, which you probably are if you're getting the Max, you should be aware of this. Like, this might not change your mind, but this is something that you should really be aware of, that the M3 Max seems to be substantially crushing the 14-inch thermal system more than the M1 generation did. The M2 was probably somewhere in the middle because its power was probably it was between the two. But you know, they've ramped up the peak power draw of these chips compared to previous generations. The M1 draws less power than the M2. The M2 draws less power than the M3 max in all those cases. And so be aware of that they have raised the power envelope without increasing the thermal dissipation capacity significantly. So if you're coming from a 14-inch M1 max and you're thinking, well, it handled my M1 max just fine in the 14, the same can't necessarily apply to the M3 max. Like, you have to reevaluate because they're not drop-in replacements in terms of power and thermals. The M3 max uses substantially more power and makes substantially more heat under load than the M1 max did. So that might change your calculus of whether you want a 14 or a 16.
And that's all. The cooling system is upgraded a tiny bit in the M3 generation versus the M2. Like, I think the heat spreader thingy on the SoC is a little bit larger in this generation, and I'm not sure about the fans if they are exactly the same. But I don't think it's entirely true they just use exactly the same cooling system. Otherwise, they would never be able to do it because the power difference in the 16 inch comparing the M2 16 inch versus M3 max 16 inch, it's pretty big difference. The M3 max is pushing like 50 watts and the M2 max was only ever getting like 36 or so. So there's a lot of extra heat.
Yeah. And the M1 generation, I think, was in the 20s. Like, it's substantially more power and heat here. And also that also results in a larger difference between the two models in battery life than there used to be. There was always a decent difference because the 16-inch battery is just much bigger. The screen uses more power than the 14 because it's bigger, but not that much more power. So the 16 is still the battery monster. But in this case, keep in mind, again, the CPU is drawing more power than the previous generations at the same, marketing name level. And also, I don't know how much of a factor this is, but if those fans are spinning faster, fans also use power. So the result after these tests, the result in this video, the 14-inch battery was substantially more drained than the 16-inch. It was not a small difference. So again, just don't make assumptions based on whatever worked for you in the M1 generation. Don't assume that the same thing will work for you in the M3 generation because the power levels are very different.
I understand everything that you guys are saying, but I don't feel like I'm bumping into thermal throttling issues anytime other than when I'm doing transcodes with FFmpeg, at which case, okay, yeah, I'm reaping what I sowed, or whatever the turn of phrase is, you know what I'm trying to say. Okay, that's
fine. You're harvesting your crops.
Yeah, right. And so the other thing is, I didn't want to go down from 64 gigs of memory. I probably could have and been fine, but I didn't want to. And in order to do that in this generation, you have to have an M3 Max. Like, that's the end of the meeting. So, in fact, you not only need an M3 Max, you need the baller M3 Max. That's the only, I'm looking at the configurator right now. It's the only option in the 14. So if I want 64 gigs, well, guess what? I'm getting an M3 Max. In fact, the Pro appears to top out at 36 gigs, which even for me is probably fine. But I didn't want that. I wanted 64. And honestly, I have zero regrets about this machine. I've been using it at home. I've been using it away from home. I freaking love this computer. And I mean, I freaking love my M1 Max as well. Don't get me wrong, but this computer's great. I haven't heard the fans except one time when I was doing a transcode. I have no reason to believe battery life is suffering compared to the last one. It's been flawless so far. I don't argue any of what you guys are saying. I'm not trying to say that you're wrong or lying or anything like that. It's just in real world use, I am not personally noticing. Not to say it's not affecting me, but I'm not noticing the results of any of these problems in the 14. And for me, and I totally understand, Marco, why you reached a different conclusion, but for me, I don't want a friggin' aircraft carrier in my backpack. And I travel with this machine often enough that matters to me. And so I made the choice I made, and I think it's the right one for me. You made the choice you made. I think it's the right one for you. And everyone's happy.
Yeah.
Why won't you just let me be happy?
No, and look, and I think it's important to point out, like, if the 14-inch still works for you, that's great. But people who are buying it should know this ahead of time, that like it's going to have these trade-offs. That the M1 generation of it had fewer trade-offs compared to the M3 generation. And if what you are seeking is the highest performing laptop, in the M1 generation, you could say, well, these are basically the same. Now you can't really say that. now the 16-inch is noticeably higher performing with a lot of workloads. So that it is worth knowing. Also, again, like if stuff like fan noise is really critical to you, then again, that's something that's worth knowing ahead of time. So that's why. Like, and for many people, they're going to still get the 14-inch like you and be totally happy with, and that's great. But again, you got to know going into it, the assumptions that you might have made from previous generations of the M series laptops are a little bit different now.
I mean,
I do wonder
I guess,
if there's not a sort of low tech solution to this. With remember, we talked about a little RGB fan cooler thing on the back of your phone, right?
Yeah, to get sustained giant frame rates. Plate.
Yeah, like I know they make laptop cooler type things, but I do wonder.
They're really quiet and elegant.
Yeah, right. But I do wonder if you say you get a 14-inch and you want to use it in desktop mode and you don't want it to thermal throttle, just how much extra cooling would it take? Probably not that much. Like, and probably could be applied externally. I don't, you know, again, caveats about condensation and don't destroy your computer and blah, 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 whatever. But like, based on how well it works on the little phone thing to sort of sustain frame rates when the phone could not do it without the cooler, I do wonder if just a little bit of extra help on a 14-inch would help it not thermal throttle at all. Because it's, you know, it's the fans are almost doing the job because, yeah, the fan speed difference is huge. Those fans are working overtime, right? But the benchmark difference is not that big. So it's just, it's like the 14 inches cooling system is overmatched, but just by a little bit. So I wonder if you just gave it a little bit of help, which is unlike lots of other computer things like, oh, I didn't get enough cores. Well, there's not really anything you can do to add more cores to your computer. But if thermal throttling is your problem, pointing a fan at the back of your laptop when it's like sitting upright, you know, in a, like in a bookshelf type thing might be enough.
I think one potential limitation there is, remember we learned this from people who wrote in like a couple of years ago, this came up where we were talking about like the MacBook Air thermal design without any fan, that like there are certain standards that different, you know, governments and things set about how hot the outside of a laptop can get for safety reasons. And so the way these are designed, usually the processor is not like heat piped directly to the exterior case. Like there's usually some kind of air gap there so that the processor is intentionally not transferring its heat much to the metal case. And because of that, it actually makes it difficult to make external coolers that are very effective because you're not getting all that heat away from the chip through the case very much. It's mostly dumping it into the air. So it's a little bit harder. So you couldn't, for instance, just stick like a Peltier Element cooler on the back of a laptop.
I mean, sure,
and
you could. You just need a temperature differential, and one exists. I mean, feel the bottom of a laptop when it's hard working. Like I know what you're saying. Like not all the heat is being dumped out there, but there's still a temperature differential. Like that's a test that someone should try. Like just consider that. And I guess the reverse of it is like if you're doing some sustained workload with your laptop, don't throw it on your bed on top of your comforter. Like don't you know yeah, what I mean? Well, like yeah. You see how kids treat laptops, they have no idea that these are like living, breathing things, right? And it's a little empathy for the machine here. Don't take your laptop and just put it on a big soft pillow surrounded by blankets. Like you need to get it with the lid closed, of course, right?
Naturally.
Give it a fighting chance.
Yeah, I just as a final note, because I'd like to move on, I feel like there's a lot of FUD going around right now. I don't have any anecdata that indicates that this problem is any worse with this generation than it was with my 2-year-old laptop. Like, yes, again, I'm not trying to argue that the facts that you're presenting to me are wrong. All I'm trying to say is that in day-to-day use, I straight up do not hear the fans. So yes, in the occasion that I can hear the fans, yes, they probably are faster. They probably are more annoying. They're probably louder. I don't debate that, but I feel like we're making a problem out of nothing here. This machine is phenomenal. If you want a desktop replacement that you occasionally move, 100% get the 16, no argument. But if you want a computer that you move occasionally and you favor that, you know, the ease of moving it over anything else, which is where I am, get the 14. Don't let these two knuckleheads try to convince you otherwise. It's a perfectly good computer. There's no.
I'm trying to convince. I also agree. I think the 16-inch is too big for a laptop, and really you should just get a desktop anyway.
So good. It's so good. The 16 is so good. There's basically no trade-off except it is large like that. But like again, like when you look at, I mean, we are so spoiled now. The 16-inch MacBook Pro is lighter than most 15 inches of most of our computing using careers. Like it is and it is 16 only because they made the bezel smaller. Like the so the footprint is roughly 15-inch class that we've had forever. The weight is similar or lighter than most 15-inch class laptops we've ever used. Like, it is glorious. Again, I'm not going to argue that the 14-inch isn't noticeably smaller and lighter. It is. Like, it is noticeably smaller and lighter. I would maybe argue that if that's really your top priority, maybe consider the Air. But the 16-inch, again, it's all relative. Yes, it is larger and heavier than yours, but compared to anything ever in the history of computing, these are all very thin and light, and it's fine. And even, like, again, like, when you're looking at, you know, if you suppose you're putting it in a backpack and bringing it to wherever, like, the weight of your backpack empty is probably a few pounds. Like, it depends on what kind of bag you have. The weight of, like, your total carry of what most people bring around in their backpacks every day, maybe 10 or 15 pounds. And so the difference in laptop weight of like a 1 pound difference between two things,
that's fair,
is
that's
not
fair.
Really that significant. It feels significant when it's in your hand, but like however you are carrying it, generally speaking, for most people, the difference between a 16-inch MacBook Pro and a 14-inch MacBook Pro being like a pound or whatever is not a massive difference in whatever they're carrying it in total. So again, if it matters to you and if you really still want to minimize it, great. I get that. Please do. But these are trade-offs that you should be aware of. And despite what you said, Casey, they weren't as severe of trade-offs in the M1 generation because the total power usage of the M1 chips was way lower. Rather, the peak power usage, like under load, the peak power usage was way lower in the M1 generation than it is in the M3 generation. So that is a difference that is worth noting. And before, again, like before with the 14-inch or with the M1 generation, you could say these computers are basically the exact same computer, just bigger and smaller. And now that's a little harder to say. There's a much bigger asterisk on that now.
So let's talk about chip packaging. Johnny Srouji had an interview in July with his alma mater, who is a college that's the name is escaping me. It was somewhere in Israel. And he went back there and did an interview with somebody there and talked a bit about chip packaging. John, do you want to either intro this or read it to me or tell me how you want to handle this?
Yeah, so this is the interview that I referenced on a past show where we're talking about 3-nanometer processes or stuff like that. But anyway, I've said that Apple executives won't reveal anything about future products, obviously, but anytime one of them talks, they'll usually say something that lets you know some vague future direction. And in the interview, Johnny Srouji said that he thought that packaging was a potential area of innovation. And I wanted to follow up on that today to first provide the excerpt from the interview. Because the whole blah, blah, blah is interesting is, I think that was like Tim Cook saying the wrist is interesting or some BS like that. And whatever the quote was from Jobs when he was talking about cell phones was similar. That's how we all knew Apple was making a phone. And so I just wanted to get the actual words that he said about packaging, because there was also recently an interview of Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger with Ben Thompson of Stratechery. Or Stratechery, however you want to pronounce it, where the Intel CEO talked about, you guessed it, packaging and how important it is to Intel and for the future. And so I feel like this is a confluence of events that's worth digging into deeper, even if as we said in the past episode of this generation, it just looks like the M3 Ultra is just going to be two M3 Maxes stuck together just like it was before, which is fine and great and it'll be awesome. But keep your eye on the future for packaging stuff. So yeah, Casey, you just want to go through the interview segment.
Sure.
Things.
So how about I'll play the role of the interviewer and you can play the role of Ben Srouji.
Sure, give me the longer one. Right.
Yep. All right. Yeah. Well, all right, fine. You know what?
We can play acted. We're gonna get Marco to be mixed in. He could be the announcer.
Oh gosh. All right. So you be the interviewer, I will be Johnny.
Don't need two people to read them. We don't need to, it can just be one person.
Play with me in the space, John. Come on. Are you really just going to leave me hanging like this?
I forgot. Wow. Is it my line?
Yes, line? It's you.
Line?
Line. We're actually doing this?
Yes. Yes, you are the interviewer.
All right. This is the interviewer. What are the next challenges in the design and architecture of processors that Apple should tackle to get to the real next generation of processing? This is where the interviewer starts asking questions like they shouldn't ask if they know they're not going to get the answer. What's the next challenge? You know, what should they tackle to get to the real next generation? I'm not asking a question about the future, but I totally am. Anyway, here's what Johnny Srouji said.
It is getting more and more challenging. Those of you who follow CMOS technology, whether it's 5 nanometer or beyond, that's getting harder and harder, which I think is great, by the way, because if it gets harder, that means Apple will try better and better. So that's good. I'm not going to describe our future roadmap, but there are many challenges. For example, when you take CMOS technology, I think one of the things that is going to be important is packaging, without getting into details. So the way you package the chip is going to be important, or maybe you architect the chip in a different way.
And I know you think, like, that's saying nothing. What are you talking about? This was the quote? Yeah, they don't say a lot. But the fact that they say anything about anything, oh, packaging, just that word, packaging, what does that mean? I mean, again, Apple already does interesting things with packaging. The silicon interposer is an interesting thing done with packaging. And we've talked a lot about packaging technology in the past, but this is the tiny tidbit they left. You know, maybe you architect your chip a different way. Maybe packaging is interesting. I do like these typical Apple bravado, where they said, the world of silicon is getting more and more difficult. And that's great for Apple, because when things get hard, like, we will excel. Like, that'll make us try harder because we're the best, and basically bring it on, because the harder it gets, the more you'll see that Apple is the best, which is great for him to say. We'll see if it actually turns out to be true. How are those cell modems going, Johnny? I thought that was, some top tier Apple executive bragging in this interview. But anyway, that's what he said about packaging. He just dropped the word packaging. So now here is the Intel CEO, Pat Gelsinger, also talking about packaging.
So I will be playing the role of Pat Gelsinger in this one, since that's the longer one. Okay. Gelsinger says, "This idea of chiplets, I think, is the new way that all chips get designed. The idea of advanced packaging, multiple chips into the advanced package, and whether that's an MCP or multi-chip packaging, whether that's a 2.5 or 3D construction, I do think that becomes the standard."
And this is Ben Thompson, the interviewer, saying, "Why is advanced packaging the future?" You can see you can ask Intel questions about the future. I know this has been a big focus for Intel. It's something that you want to talk about. And from everything I know, your technology is leading the way. Why is that so important in addition to the traditional Moore's law? Why do we need to start stacking these chiplets? Give me the top reasons. So this, you know, Ben is asking a good question here, which is like, of all the things, the problems Intel has, and you can read the full interview. You know, he's interviewed the new Intel CEO a few times. Intel's got some problems. They fell behind. They're, you know, getting beat in the fab business by TSMC. Why in the world does Intel care anything about packaging? And more importantly, why is Intel putting tons of money into innovations in packaging? And so he's asking, like, you know, what's the deal? Give me the top reasons for the whole focus on packaging.
One is, now you're able to take the performance-sensitive transistors and move them to the leading-edge node, but leverage some other technologies for other things. So you get to mix and match technologies more efficiently, effectively this way. John, would you like to jump in and explain what Pat Gelsinger said?
This is part of Intel's problem, is they, you know, their fabs fell behind. They couldn't get off of whatever. Were they stuck on 14 nanometer for ages, right? And TSMC went ahead of them and has been ahead since then. And so they're like, look, We know at Intel that we have some fab problems. In fact, Intel is paying TSMC to fab a bunch of its stuff, right? And they're saying, one of the things that we can do by breaking the chips up into smaller individual pieces is get the most important parts to be fabbed by TSMC, not by us, on the good process node, and then use other lesser fabs, like Intel's fabs, to fab the parts of the chip where it doesn't matter as much. So if you're Intel, you don't want to pay TSMC and Intel, you can read all about it in Ben's coverage, but Intel is trying to split, where they're like, we're going to have a fabbing part of the company, and then we're going to have the chip design part of the company, and we're going to pretend like they're separate, right? So the fabbing part is way behind and needs to catch up, but the part that owns like x86 and makes the chips, we think that's good. So, you know, they're using TSMC, but they don't want to have US TSMC for everything. That would get very expensive. Intel's big advantage is they fab their own chips and they design their own chips. They're, you know, vertical integration and everything, right? So like, this is why, in one reason why packaging is important. Intel can pay the minimum amount required to the company with the good fabs to make the part of the chip where it's most important for it to be on the top process level. And then they can use cheaper stuff for the other parts.
Second, we can actually compose the chiplets to more appropriate die sizes to maximize defect density as well. If you have a monster server die, you're going to be dictated to be N-2, N-3, just because of the monster die size. I get to carve up that server chip. I get to move the advanced nodes for computing more rapidly and not be subject to some of the issues, defect density early in the life of a new process technology.
So this is about Intel, you know, setting aside SoCs, where it's a whole bunch of stuff on a big giant. It's a system on a chip. Their giant server chips, like the huge, like 56 core Xeon things, are just a single gigantic chip, and you have to fab that in a single. It's fabbed in a single die, and if some part of that screws up, like the more area you start covering on the silicon wafer, the more stuff you put there, the more chances there's going to be some error, and you might have to throw out the whole chip, right? And so this is another advantage to packaging, is like if you just make it out of smaller parts, A, if it's bad, you're only throwing away like a smaller area of your wafer. You don't have to throw away this huge square. You throw away the little square. And B, your defect density can be lower. He says maximizing defect density, but whatever, he meant minimizing, right? That you'll get more of those littler things that you fab will come offline and be completely error-free, whereas trying to just get a single error-free humongous Xeon is difficult.
SRAMs in particular, SRAM scaling will become a bigger and bigger issue going forward. So I actually don't get benefit by moving a lot of my cache to the next generation node like I do for logic power and performance. I actually want to have a 3D construct where I have lots of cache and a base die and put the advanced computing on top of it into a 3D sandwich. And now you get the best of a cache architecture and the best of the next generation of Moore's Law. So it actually creates a much more effective architectural model in the future. Additionally, generally, you're struggling with the power, performance, and speed of light between chips.
Yeah, so this whole technique, this is a particular technology that Intel has advanced with, which lets them take power and feed it through the layers of the sandwich in a more efficient way to get to precisely where they want it. I think that's what they're referring to here. The sandwiching isn't just because of that, but Intel has an innovative way to send power up to the bottom of the chip instead of sending it through the top. Because when you send it through the top, you got to weave it through around a bunch of obstacles. Where you send it through the bottom, there's nothing in the way because you make these layered sandwiches or whatever. That's what that's talking about. And you know, SRAM is like, look, the SRAM is what we were talking about before with the GPU RAM that was being shared better with dynamic caching. It's faster than the RAM that's out on your RAM chips, like your main memory, but it's not the same as registers. It's kind of in between there. It's like very expensive RAM, or each little bit of RAM takes a large number of transistors, but it's much faster than regular RAM, and it's in the CPU. And I say, I'm like, you don't get any benefit of doing that on 3 nanometers. So not only do you not want to waste money doing it because it would be more expensive, you don't get benefit from doing it anyway. So keep that on a different lower process and then sandwich it all together.
Any other questions for me, Ben?
Yeah, I'm Ben again. All right, so how do you solve that with chiplets when they're no longer on the same die?
In the chiplet construct, we're going to be able to put tens of thousands of bond connections between different chiplets inside of an advanced package. So you're going to be able to have very high bandwidth, low latency, low power consumption interfaces between chiplets. It also becomes very economical for design cycles. Hey, I can design a chiplet with this I/O and use it for multiple generations.
You can see how all the stuff that I just described would be appealing to Apple. Apple's already making SoCs, which are essentially single dies, system on a chips that have a bunch of stuff in them. And they're getting pretty big. That's part of the reason the Ultras have been two maxes weaved together with the silicon interposer rather than just being a single large chip the size of an Ultra, because that would be even more expensive to manufacturers, but also probably part of the reason we didn't have the quad, right? So Apple would love the idea that you could take subunits of this, like the thing that does I/O or whatever, and reuse that between generations. Because if between generations, like, yo, it's, you know, whatever we're on now, Thunderbolt 3, Thunderbolt 4, that lasts a couple generations. I think both the M2 and the M3 had the same speed Thunderbolt interface. So if that was in a separate chiplet, you could just reuse that one from before on the future chip. That could still be 7 nanometer, for example. I don't know if this is the right part of the chip to be reused, but you can design it once and reuse that little sub chiplet in future generations, as long as you can do an interconnect between all of these that has all the attributes that describe low latency, blah, blah, blah. So far, Apple's packaging innovation has been the interposer, which is technically impressive and it makes the Ultra possible. But this is more like talking like a more general purpose thing of like lots of different little, you know, a city of chips, lots of different little islands on your chip to even to just make what Apple does currently in a single SoC. And that can make things less expensive and improve your yields as well.
And then you want to tell me about the Universal Chiplet Interconnect Express. Is that a train, John?
Yeah. UCI and then lowercase e. So this is one of these multi-company consortiums to do exactly what we were just describing. So this is a press release from March 2nd, 2022. It says Intel, along with Advanced Semiconductor Engineering, AMD, ARM, Google Cloud, Meta, Microsoft, Qualcomm, Samsung, and TSMC, have announced the establishment of an industry consortium to promote an open die-to-die interconnect standard called Universal Chiplet Interconnect Express, or UCIe. The chiplet ecosystem created by UCIe is a critical step in the creation of a unified standard for interoperable chiplets, which will ultimately allow for next generation of technological innovations. Apple's not on that list, but TSMC is, and Apple has a good relationship with them. So if we're looking towards a future where it becomes untenable to continue making larger and larger dies, you know, with everything on them in these SoCs, a good industry standard system for making chiplets at whatever the most economical and useful size is and weaving them together to essentially form an SoC out of it seems like a good idea. Doing it all in one die probably still has advantages, but price may not be one of those advantages. And again, Intel is super interested because they essentially can't do that without having TSMC do all of their fabbing for them if they want the top tier technology. Apple doesn't currently have that problem, but the fact Johnny Cerugi mentioned stuff about packaging and the fact that this whole chiplets thing, like other companies are already doing this. AMD has been big into the chiplets thing for a while. Intel is putting a lot of money and research into this, and their chips that they're going to be coming out with use some of this technology. I think it's unavoidable that Apple will start using it too. Why am I interested in all this? You know why. So to keep the dream alive of a Mac Pro chip that is not the same as one you can get in a Mac Studio. And what's going to make that possible? Apparently, with the approach they use for the past two generations, not economically feasible. If it's ever going to be economically feasible, we need a change. This change in packaging could bring that about. Stay tuned. I don't know. 2027? Who knows?
Oh, my. All right, John. In keeping with the idea of keeping the dream alive, tell me about Air Network Change.
This is a nightmare. It's not a dream.
Touche.
Air Network Change continues. Some more research from the internet about this. So here is a Stack Overflow question. This person asks, whenever my iPhone and Mac OS are on the same Wi-Fi, Chrome and Mac OS often reports the error network changed. I found that whenever my iPhone and Mac OS on the same Wi-Fi, a record will often appear in the routing table in Mac OS and disappear after a few seconds. When this route record appears, my Chrome will most likely have an error network changed error. I turned off the iPhone's Wi-Fi, the routing and the record in Mac OS disappeared, and Chrome no longer had the error. So this is, everyone is always looking for like, what causes this? And so they start looking at anything like, what changes my network? What is it about my network that has changed? And they'll spot something and they'll find a thing to attribute it to. And they'll stop that thing by saying, it looks like it's happening because my phone is here. And if I turn off my Wi-Fi, I fix the problem. Every single one of these that has been reported, I have experimented with. And it doesn't actually eliminate the problem. It just moves it around, right? Because the problem is the network changed and Chrome flips out about it. Is the problem that the network is changing? Is the problem that Chrome's flipping out about it? Is it both? Either way, if you stop the thing that changes in your network, doesn't mean that something else won't also change your network and cause the error. But I'm glad that somebody found something that helps them. This next one is about tail scale. Gil Penderson says the tail scale VPN used to trigger this, but they fixed it with, and there's a link to a patch. So this is tail scale patching their own code to avoid this error because they were seeing this error happening and they were saying, hey, this thing that we're doing, macOS is flipping out about it. So, you know, basically it says iOS/macOS. So it's apparently not just a Mac thing, will reconfigure their routing anytime anything minor changes in the netmap. And so they're changing their code to not do that because they don't want to anger iOS/macOS. This is a change that committed in 2020. So are iOS and macOS, you know, changing their routing more? Is there something that was part of the operating system that's causing it? Lots of theories about this. One that's not even in the notes here is about if you have a dev device, like if you have an iPhone that is configured as a dev device, there's apparently a new way that Macs communicate to the phones for purposes of development. That also uses a, you know, network connection that's brought up and torn down and apparently causes network to be changed as far as Chrome concerned and it flips out. So anyway, here's an anonymous bit that's getting us closer to the root of the problem. And this is an explanation of it from the perspective of Chrome, Chromium, whatever. Because again, this is not just a Mac or iOS problem. This happens to be on Linux. This is a part of the problem is clearly with the Chrome/Chromium browser engine. But the operating systems participate in it as well because they're the ones that control the network that is changing. Anyway, Anonymous writes, The network layer from Chromium is available as a standalone cross-platform library called CrowNet, which is open source and used in other non-Google applications. I work at Google on a major Android app that uses CrowNet extensively, so I've got experience with error network changed. This issue appears to be with Quick, Q-U-I-C, which is the UDP-based web protocol thing. We'll put a link to the Wikipedia page. You can read about it. And or HTTP 3, which is a new version of HTTP, which is sensitive to changing networks. Whenever the networks on the device change, the connection needs to be reset. This isn't exactly a bug. It's a necessary step. Not doing this would mean connections wouldn't work properly. Unfortunately, this causes error network change when the device's network changed. As previously mentioned, this can be for non-obvious reasons such as Docker desktop customizing the networks repeatedly, VPN apps misbehaving, cell signal dropping in and out, etc. There are ways in which this can be fixed. First, not using HTTP/quick is the easiest. Safari and other Apple stuff doesn't use this yet, so isn't currently experiencing these issues. However, this will likely change as Apple rolls out HTTP3 support. Apart from this issue, it's a much better technology, particularly for mobile devices. So this is the first offered explanation of, hey, why doesn't Safari have this problem? The theory is, oh, Safari doesn't use Quick or HTTP3, and so it's not going to see any of these errors. Difficult to test, because as far as I was able to determine in conversing with this person, there's no way to disable HTTP3 in Quick in Chrome, to disable it entirely. There's some flags in Chrome flags where you can turn some things off, but I think you can't turn it off entirely. So it's hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison. But you pin your hopes on the smallest thing. If Apple does plan on rolling out HTTP3 or Quick, their browser is going to break like Chrome is. And hopefully they'll be like, oh, geez, this browser has become useless because half of my HTTP connections fail. Let's see if we can fix this. As opposed to now, where apparently no one is doing anything. Next possible fix. OSs and networking apps will need to be more careful about network changes. Apple will probably fix this in a Sonoma Point release. Other platforms I've seen this on are working on fixes. I wish I had this person's optimism. Will it be fixed in a Sonoma Point release? Does Apple even know about this? I haven't bothered reporting this because they're just going to say it's a Chrome error. And I'm not sure they're wrong. Like, I honestly don't know how much of the blame to apportion to Chrome versus macOS. Anecdotal evidence is that this is way worse in Sonoma. And there are a bunch of new network-related demons for various things that people have assigned blame to. Oh, it's because of the Yutun thing. It's because of talking to a developer iPhone device. You know, it's because of Docker. It's because of a VPN. It's because whenever your iPhone and your Mac are on the same Wi-Fi network, it happens. Like, I don't know, but I don't know how to communicate this to anybody involved other than to say Chrome no longer works on Mac in a reliable way, like in a fundamental, no longer useful as a browser kind of way, because, you know, some large percentage of your requests just fail, and it's not great. Finally, the last thing, there is an experimentation going on in CrowNet to improve things by migrating connections across network interfaces. This is the migrate sessions on network change V2 flag or feature or whatever. We'll put a link to the thing in the show notes. This isn't just a bug fix, though. It has trade-offs, so it likely needs to be done in combination with improvements from OSs and networking apps. So the idea behind this thing is, hey, if there's some connection in this CrowNet networking library and the network changes and we have to, you know, not use that connection anymore because it won't work, whatever was using that connection, why don't we smoothly migrate it over to the new working connection? And then the application that is using CrowNet, which would be the Chromium browser engine, doesn't need to worry that that happened. It will just continue to work. That would be great, but it's not just a bug fix, because there are performance implications of that. Migrating it is not free. It takes time. And it's not the same as just not having the network change. So I don't know what the solution here is here, but it's extremely frustrating. We did not have an error network change shirt as part of this sale, but I'm seriously thinking about it for future ones. This continues to happen. And then the final bit, this is really the icing on the cake. This is not seemingly related to error network change, but kind of is. This was a toot by someone named Thomas who said, I just learned what the user interface and the SpaceX capsules run. The capsules that provide life support for people traveling into space and have to be absolutely reliable. The user interface that controls an explosion. It runs a home compiled version of Chromium, and the UI is written in JavaScript. Now, this person wrote this to say, can you believe they're using web technologies and a thing that has to be reliable? But that's not the thing that sticks out. The thing that sticks out is the word Chromium. Do you think if they have error network changed in a SpaceX rocket, that might be a problem? And who's responsible for fixing that bug? I'm sure it's running Linux or whatever. But again, people running Chrome on Linux or Chromium-based things on Linux are also experiencing this problem. Sometimes I feel like I'm the only person with this problem, but every time I talk about it on the show, people send me toots on Mastodon. Here I am. I'm getting it. I'm getting a network changed. I got people on Linux, people on Macs. So far, no one on iOS, because maybe those errors are hidden from you on most iOS apps. But I mean, I still think my Window Dragon bug is more important because I could just use Safari. But for the people in the SpaceX capsules that have a UI that's running Chromium, maybe talk to your bosses about this.
That is mildly terrifying. Ay-yay-yay. All right. So speaking of things that are mildly terrifying, let's talk AI. As we record this, it is Monday. What's today? The 20th? Is that right? Yes, Monday the 20th. In the last 3 days, there have been approximately, I'm going to carry the 7,304 different CEOs for OpenAI. I don't know.
Somehow still only one board.
Right. Yeah.
We've been recording for a while, so.
Yeah. Right.
That's also fair. So I don't really have too much to say about this, but
read the headlines in the notes.
All right. So these are the headlines, and we'll link these.
I think this is like 48 hours span, 24, 48.
Yeah. It's been something almost like no that. Time.
So these are the headlines as per The Verge. Sam Altman fired a CEO of OpenAI. That was on the 17th.
And by the way, out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's get through the headlines. Yeah. I think it's worth unpacking all this. And then next, Twitch co-founder Emmett Shear is the new CEO of OpenAI. That was apparently today. Microsoft hires former OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, also today. Hundreds of OpenAI employees starting to resign and join Microsoft today. Is Sam Altman joining Microsoft? Satya Nadella doesn't seem to know.
Hours between those. How can you have yes, it's a comedy of errors, but then like every time there's a headline, it's like, this is a thing that happened. And it's like, but has it?
Yeah, exactly.
I skip the ones where it's like, oh, he was fired, but there are negotiations for him to come back. But no, he's not coming back. But yes, he is coming back, but they're talking about coming back. But now he's at Microsoft. But has he been hired by Microsoft? And this is not just like, oh, we're wondering what's going on. That's why the headline says, is Sam Altman joining Microsoft? Satya Nadella, who, by the way, is the CEO of Microsoft, doesn't seem to know. Satya Nadella announced, hey, Sam Altman's coming to Microsoft. But then when asked about it, like hours later, it was like, well, not really sure. I don't check back in a few hours. Boy.
Yeah. So let me try to give the quick executive summary of this. Now, I'm surely going to get a little bit wrong, but the general gist of it is, I think it was late Friday Eastern time, there was a blog post from the OpenAI board, basically, that said that Sam Altman, who was the former CEO, maybe by the time you're listening to this, might be the CEO again, who knows? But former CEO had basically not, what was the phrase they used? Not been forthcoming wasn't the word they used, but it was something along those lines. Like,
it was
or
pretty
been,
severe. It was
vague, but like, as you know, normally when a CEO is fired, this is the privilege of being in the executive ranks. When a regular person is fired, you just get fired. Right? But if you're a CEO, no matter how terrible whatever you did was, no matter how badly you screwed up, you're always like, moving on to spend more time with your family or want to pursue other interests, or like, they have some euphemism about how you're, it's not like we're firing him. It's a mutual decision we've all come to, and he's decided to leave, and he's, you know, pursuing his passions in this other realm, and we thank him for all his blah, blah, blah. And this wasn't like that. This is as close as you're ever going to get to saying we fired him because we don't like him.
Yeah, think of what happened with the Apple guy whose name is escaping me. Oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank.
Paper Master
Jobs?
No, neither of them. The software guy, gosh darn it, with an F. No, not an F, not Fidel.
Not Paper Master?
No.
Paper Master got fired.
Forstall, thank you. God bless. I couldn't think of his name. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was that's how I remember it being with Forstall. It was basically like, it was clear that he got fired, but everyone, you know, put on the happy face. We would like Scott to spend more time with his family. Yes, I would like to spend more time with my family.
In those type of statements, there's something from the person who was fired, like, quote, you know, whatever, quotes from them, right? They'll say, like, I'm happy that I spent all my time with this company. I'm glad to be moving on, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's a participatory process. But right. What happened with Sam Altman The story I heard on a podcast I was listening to is that he was on stage doing something like in his official capacity as CEO. And he said, OK, well, you know, thanks, everybody. I have to go. I have a meeting. In that meeting, he got on a call. This is, I was listening to the Verge's podcast about this. He got into the call using Google Meet. And one of the people on the show said, even for $10 billion, no one will use Teams. Because Microsoft invested $10 billion or whatever in OpenAI. So anyway, he goes to his meeting. He sits down and it's you know, an online meeting, right? And all they did in the online meeting was read him the blog post you just referred to, Casey. They just put in, do in these meetings. You have a script, you stick to it so you don't get sued. You just read the words. So if you're wondering like, oh, they must have had an extensive meeting in which they explained to him why he was fired. When we say this came out of nowhere, didn't come out of nowhere like to us on the outside, because what do we know? Came out of nowhere to Sam Altman, who just got done doing a CEO thing and said, oh, I got to go to a meeting. And they just read him a thing and said, yeah, you're fired.
And by the way, the thing he was doing, like having their whole developer conference, was widely lauded by the industry as like an amazing thing. Everyone thought he did an amazing job. This is a great path to be on.
Everyone's excited about OpenAI.
Yeah, everyone's super excited about OpenAI and him. Like, it was, that's why when this news dropped that the board fired him, everyone in the entire tech business was like, what? Are you serious? Is this a joke? Like, what happened?
Yeah. So here's from the blog post I was able to dig it up while you guys were talking. This is the blog post from the OpenAI board. Mr. Altman's departure follows a deliberate review process by the board, which concluded that he was not consistently candid in his communications with the board, hindering its ability to exercise its responsibilities. The board no longer has confidence in his ability to continue leading OpenAI.
Which, by the way, like, that's a really serious accusation. Like, that, that is like, potentially misleading the board is in many cases a crime. Like, that is a really serious accusation. That's why, like, this isn't just, oh, we had creative differences, we, you know, we don't like him anymore. That's a very serious thing to throw around, what they threw around.
And by the way, as far as I understand it, the board doesn't have to have a reason. Like, they have complete control. There's no like power struggle or whatever. This, the structure of this company is such that the board can decide, oh, we don't want you to be CEO for, I think, for pretty much any reason. Like, he needs to do anything wrong. Like, it happens all the time. The board's like, we want a different CEO. We want to go in a different direction. That happens all the time. They don't need to explain, which is why you can do the, oh, they're going to spend more time with the family or whatever. Whatever the real reason is, it's not like they need to make something up. Like, oh, we can't fire him unless we say that he lied to us. They could have just said later, but they threw that in there to say, oh, and we have reasons. We think he has not been, quote unquote, consistently candid. Like, they didn't have to put that in there for any reason other than to just, I mean, I don't know. You know, they thought maybe this will give us cover because it's vague enough. People can imagine some terrible thing happened. But bottom line is, apparently a majority, we don't even know how much because it's not a public company. So it's not like they have public records to say, was this a unanimous vote? Did everybody vote to kick him out or whatever? But a majority of the people on the board decided they don't want him to be CEO anymore. And they made this decision without consulting Sam Altman at all. I mean, maybe they've had press conversations about it. Maybe he should have known it's coming because they said in their last meeting, if you do really well in that dev conference, you're fired. I don't know what they might have said to him.
Right. So the impression I get I don't have a lot of, nobody has facts here at the moment, but the impression I got based on the coverage that I've read is that there were two different factions or tribes, I think Sam had called them at one point or another, two different tribes within OpenAI. OpenAI was originally founded in 2014, 2015, thereabouts, as a nonprofit. And their theory was, we want to make, you know, basically artificial general intelligence. We want to make, you know, AI. But we understand that there, with this great power comes great responsibility. And we want to do this to improve the life or the lives of people everywhere. But we're going to try to do it very methodically, very deliberately, very safely. And that was how the company was founded. And it's not even really a company, I guess. It's a nonprofit, right? So that's how it was founded. Well, at some point, you know, Altman swoops in. I don't recall exactly when it was in the timeline, but it's clear that Sam Altman is very Silicon Valley VC, which I personally find to be a very ugly stereotype. Like, I just don't care for that whole like grow, take over.
And
the
he is the
mindset.
Embodiment of that stereotype. He used to be with Y Combinator, which is also kind of a poster child for that type of VC.
Right.
Yeah. And so he's not the guy who had the day phone, night phone. He's the guy who wore the multiple polo shirts at the same time.
Yeah, sorry to keep track of all. That's him, yeah.
Exactly. Now, and I'm trying to make plain my, to quote Merlin, my priors on this. Like, I find that whole Silicon Valley mindset to be very off-putting. You know, grow no matter what. We don't care who we run over in the process. Grow. You know, let's make money. And that's all that matters is making money. Nothing else matters. Grow and make money. Or sometimes you don't even have to make money. You just grow. Well, so anyway, so consider that when I give one of my, you know, lip turns up as I tell you this story. But nevertheless, so Sam comes in and he's grow, money. And everything, I guess everyone was kind of coexisting okay. And even though they disagreed internally, everything was mostly all right. Well, then they release ChatGPT, about a year ago, and it makes a tremendous splash. I think a lot of people are saying it's the quickest adopted consumer product ever, because, you know, they had something like 100 million signups in the span of like 4 minutes, not literally, but you know what I mean? And so now money is becoming a thing, like for real. And suddenly we have to pay the piper on this division between money, and let's do this for the good of all people. And their chief scientist, Ilya something or other, I don't have the name in front of me, I guess was more on the let's play it safe, let's be deliberate, let's do this for the good of humanity. And Sam was very much money. And at some point, it appears something gave. And the rumblings that I heard, not from like sources or anything, just based on the reporting I read, was that Ilya had convinced the board, of which I think he is a part of the board, let's get rid of Sam. And then all hell broke loose. And now, as we record on Monday night, we don't really know what the latest and greatest is. But I understand, you know, both sides of this. Like, on the one side, if the board really did establish, or if OpenAI really was established as a nonprofit, which I think is factual, I don't think that's up for grabs, it is within reason for them to say, well, hold on, suddenly we've taken a turn and pivoted to money. We don't like that. And Sam seems to, by most metrics, have pivoted them in that direction. So if we don't like this pivot to money, then we probably don't like Sam anymore. So on the surface, I don't have a problem with that. And again, my priors tell me, yeah, screw that Silicon Valley nut job. You know, let's do this for the good of people rather than the good of the almighty
dollar.
Wait
till you hear about the other side of that, because I think that they're both nut jobs.
Well, that's fair, too. Yeah. That's fair, too. But I'm just trying to make plain, you know, this is my biases coming to light. That being said, unquestionably, ChatGPT and the work of OpenAI and DALL-E and, you know, all this AI stuff, whether or not you think it's cool, whether or not you think it's good, I think unquestionably it's important, and it's been making a big damn splash. And I think that there's a lot of interesting things here. And unlike blockchain, I think there's a lot of fascinating threads that we can pull. And I think that there's a lot there. And because of that, I also have sympathy for the let's grow this product and see what the world can do with it. Let's not slow down. Let's not, you know, be deliberate about it. Screw it. Let's just figure it out as we go, which is when Silicon Valley is at its best. So I have very mixed feelings about this. And I mean, as someone who likes drama more than I should, because I'm a grown ass man, I really shouldn't enjoy drama this much. But oh, this is delicious drama, and I am here for the drama of it. But I honestly don't know, you know, who's right, who's wrong. I'm not sure any of us do. I don't know what to make of this, but it is a mess. And it's been a mess every other hour since late Friday evening.
Yeah, by the time you hear this episode, who knows what will have happened. You know, yep. I think this is actually, I mean, a lot of, this is the most Silicon Valley thing about this is that a lot of the companies that, you know, from my youth that sort of came out of Silicon Valley, they were at the forefront of some technology that they were at the right place at the right time, right? They decided to make personal computers, and personal computers were just becoming possible, right? You know, you got your Apples, you got your Intel, right? You know, microchips, memory, you know, CPUs, x86, Microsoft with the software. Like, they're riding a wave of something, right? And those particular companies, especially, you know, we know a lot of the names of the founders, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, right? A lot of them were younger people, and pretty much none of them went into it thinking, I'm going to found what's going to become what we know today as tech giants. Because that's not what, you know, if you tried to tell a young Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak what Apple will look like today, they'd be like, yeah, right. Right. No one thinks that's going to happen. So what happens with these companies that are incredibly successful is they're made up of people, the founders, but also usually they bring in other people to help them run the company. And especially for companies that experience explosive growth, the people who are responsible for running that company, they're just people. Sometimes they're people who've never done anything like this before. And so if you're wondering, how can this company that's been so financially successful and apparently has such amazing technology not have their governance straightened out and basically, you know, conduct their business in this ridiculous way with this whipsawing of the CEO being fired and asking him to come back and regretting telling him to leave and all the other stuff? It's because they're a young tech company riding the wave of a new technology run by a bunch of people who are bad at doing this. And that's, I mean, look, Steve Jobs was fired from Apple by a bunch of people that were brought on to run the company. That was probably the wrong decision for them to do at that time. If they had, you know, nurtured his talent, perhaps they would have had a more successful 90s. But you can also understand why they fired him, because, you know, read the history. Like, a lot of these companies in their early days at least run up to the edge of being, you know, doing something terrible, but being run in a way that is not, I'm not going to say not sane, but that is not the way you expect a very wealthy company to run. That's even with Google. They have the two founders, and we have to bring in the adults to help run things. And, you know, it can go badly in so many different ways. It's very rare that you get a company that manages to get through this sort of awkward adolescence and sustain its success into something that continues and becomes like a company that, you know, that is more reliable and steady and does not have weird boardroom drama like this. So I'm not saying that this is unique to OpenAI at all. In fact, like I said, I think this is the most Silicon Valley thing that they've done. That said, the people in these two camps here, the Sam Altman and the OpenAI people, are a little bit weird. They're both sides are a little bit weird. So we didn't talk about the Microsoft stuff, but like OpenAI is this nonprofit. Microsoft wanted to do a thing with them. So here's the thing with OpenAI. Their goal is to make artificial general intelligence, like HAL 9000 or whatever, that doesn't kill you. Right. They haven't done that. Yeah. Yeah. They haven't done that, to be clear. That's like their aspirational goal. It's like their mission statement. But what they did do was make ChatGPT. And it turns out that ChatGPT is a useful thing that people can do stuff with. And everyone's interested in it. And Microsoft was interested in it. And they said, hey, we would like to do stuff with your technology too. The problem OpenAI has is they want to make artificial general intelligence, but it turns out doing anything, even approaching that, costs tons and tons of money. And so OpenAI's idea was like, we'll raise money somehow and people will give us money because they know we're doing the good work to make HAL 9000 not kill us, right? And the amount of money they were able to raise was a fraction of the amount that they would need. Microsoft came and said, we kind of like that things you're doing over there. How about we let you use our massive computing resources and our data centers to the tune of billions of dollars worth of free credits, like little token Chuck E. Cheese tokens? Now you can run your stuff in Azure, because OpenAI OpenAI can't do anything without large amounts of computers, which takes large amounts of money. And they're a nonprofit, and their idea was like, we'll raise that money. People will give us money to pursue this. They just did not get as much money as they would need. But ChatGPT, Microsoft's like, kind of like that. Right. So they did this deal where Microsoft is like giving them $10 billion, most of which is in the form of credits to run stuff in their Azure, you know, cloud computing stuff. But how can they do that? Well, if you look at the org chart, it's like there's a nonprofit and the nonprofit controls this other for-profit thing that gets money from Microsoft. But the for-profit part, it's profit capped or something like that. Mm-hmm, anyway, mm-hmm. It's entirely controlled by the nonprofit, right? But still, Microsoft has this financial interest. And by the way, as part of this deal, Microsoft gets all the rights to the OpenAI IP, like their intellectual property, whatever. I don't know what their intellectual property is, but presumably whatever it is they use to make ChatGPT, Microsoft now has the rights to that, I think forever, as part of this mm-hmm. $10 billion deal, right? The only thing Microsoft doesn't have the rights to, and this is another one of those great deals, kind of like a Microsoft doing the Internet Explorer thing and saying, don't worry, we'll give you X percent of all of our Internet Explorer sales, and then giving it away, Internet Explorer away for free to everybody. And so that person got nothing. Anyway, the company that got nothing from that. OpenAI is like, okay, we'll do this $10 billion deal. We'll get access to your computing resources, which we kind of need to like literally do anything because we don't have enough money to do this AI stuff. We don't have enough money to pay for the computers to do it. But what we won't give you, and we'll license you our current technology. But what we won't give you is anything having to do with artificial general intelligence. So if we invent HAL 9000, Microsoft, you don't get it. And Microsoft's like, okay, I guess. And it's, you know, and Microsoft's actually thinking, they're never going to do that. It doesn't matter. So they retain the right to the fantasy thing that they want to make, but gave Microsoft the rights to all the other stuff. And so Microsoft's, you know, doing all this stuff with their, you know, a Copilot, ChatGPT, blah, blah, like all that stuff. You know, ChatGPT, the fact that it does useful things, that is a product that can make money. Microsoft can incorporate that technology into its own products, Microsoft Office, GitHub, everything, and use that to make money. That's what everyone's doing. Meanwhile, the nonprofits over there are going, what are they doing making products and making money for? Don't they understand we're trying to make HAL 9000 and we're trying to make sure HAL 9000 doesn't kill us? And so there's already a disconnect. And so on the one side of it is like, you have a technology that people will pay money to use. I forget what the numbers are, but like, yeah, they got 100 million users. They're making some huge amount of revenue too, because they charge for access to this stuff. And of course, Microsoft, to the extent that Microsoft incorporates any of this technology into their products, that helps them sell more of their products, which of course they make money on. So it's, you know, it's a product business. Hey, we have a thing we came up with where it was Google search or, you know, whatever, and we can use it to make money. And that's what Sam Altman's out there doing, using a product to make money. And then the OpenAI people who are like, AI is going to kill us. We need to create it in a... First, we need to create it, but we need to create it the right way so it doesn't kill us. And everyone else is like, yeah, but you haven't created it. But we've got this thing over here called ChatGPT that people want to pay for. That's not AI, even though everyone calls it that. But it is a product that people want to use. So can we have a developer day and make an API and charge people for API access and do deals with Microsoft? And it's like, okay, I guess. But eventually, like, no. We're making HAL 9000. We don't like the other stuff. Stop it. And so now you have this disconnect. And if you think about what OpenAI is, it's this mission statement. It's a bunch of employees that implement this mission statement. And then it is the output, the knowledge and the output of those employees. And so Sam Altman apparently was popular within the company. So when he left and went to Microsoft, or did he? Of the 700 or so employees at OpenAI, about 500 signed a letter that said, hey, if you don't bring him back or if you don't all quit or whatever, we're all going to go to Microsoft, because Microsoft said we have a standing offer to go work for them instead. So if Microsoft gets Sam Altman and 500 of the 700 employees, what is the nonprofit left with? Microsoft already has the rights to all the IP of everything they actually made, right? Because they didn't make HAL 9000. So they got the rights to that. And if all their employees also go over there and they have the former CEO, then OpenAI has a mission statement and 200 loyal employees left. And really, I guess those people can regroup and use their $10 billion of Azure bucks to figure out how to make HAL 9000 any day now. Meanwhile, Sam Altman and Microsoft are over there continuing to sell access to ChatGPT to autocomplete stuff when you type reminders in, or whatever the hell they're doing to make money. The reason I think both camps are a little bit weird is because Sam Altman's in the, as Casey alluded to before, the grow, 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 you know, boil the ocean, kill all the poor people so we can make it another buck, because in the end, what really matters are the people who are going to live a trillion years from now. You know, lots of interesting philosophical excuses to be a jerk today, right? But really, it's for the future. Anyway, money, money, money. And on the flip side, the people who think AI is going to come and kill us all, and they need to be really careful about how they create it. And you're like, what's going to kill us all? And they're like, oh, the thing no one's been able to invent yet. But when they do, it's going to be really bad. It's like, yeah, dragons can kill us all too, but there aren't any dragons. Like, but there could be. You're right. There could be. Someone could genetically engineer a dragon, but do you have a dragon? No. But I think I know how to make one. All right, we'll get back to me about the dragon thing. Yeah. So it's kind of like self-driving cars. It's like any day now it'll come. It's like, well, no one's ever done it. But all these companies sprung up about the promise, you know, like based on the promise of like, well, you know, in 5 years there'll be safe self-driving cars. So we need to build business around that reality. And that reality has not happened. And so a lot of those companies are having problems. So OpenAI is trying to pursue HAL 9000, but I don't think they know how, like everyone else who has tried before them. But unlike lots of other companies, they've made a useful thing that is a marketable consumer product in the course of trying to do that research. And it seems that useful consumer product is not compatible with their mission statement, because that's not what they wanted to do. Oh, that's cool and all. That's a step along the way. But let's not get distracted by trying to make a multi-billion dollar business about out of this useful thing that we've made. And by the way, OpenAI is not the only company that's done this. Lots of other companies have similar things. So it is kind of a cutthroat business. OpenAI is, you know, seems to be the leader in this field, which is why Microsoft is interested in them and why they did that deal. But it's not like this is unknown elsewhere. What is unknown everywhere is HAL 9000. That doesn't exist. Don't. And so if you're scared of it existing, okay, it would be scary if it did exist, but it doesn't. And I'll be more interested once you think you have a road to making it. Like, can you go from ChatGPT to HAL 9000? Maybe. Maybe this is step one of five. Maybe step one of 5,000. Or maybe you're just barking up the wrong tree and this approach isn't going to work anymore than planes that flap their wings. We'll see. But yeah, that's kind of the state of the world. And these two camps, like, at least the Sam Altman thing, you're like, okay, I've got this guy's number. I've seen people like this before. I know what he's doing. He's making products. He's selling them, right? It makes sense, right? And the OpenAI people are more like very confused sort of monks who have noble, if misguided, goals and great ambitions. But what they increasingly don't have are people and money to accomplish that. And it's all through their own kind of, I'm not going to say mismanagement, but through their own apparent misreading of the situation, which is, what did you think you actually have? Oh, we control the company and we can fire him. But if all the employees log to him and he goes to Microsoft and all your employees leave, then you've really got nothing left. So I feel kind of bad for OpenAI because I think that they I admire the nobility of their mission, even if I think their reasoning or predictions are a little bit silly. I don't particularly admire the nobility or lack thereof of Sam Altman's ambitions, but at least it's a devil that I know.
Yeah, and I think what they created is so incredibly commercially valuable and commercializable that I don't think there was any chance of this going any other way. Like, the idealists in OpenAI who wanted to keep it really nonprofit for the good of everybody, That is a noble goal. It's an interesting idea, but there was no way that's going to happen.
The only way it would have worked is all the employees agreed. If they said, we are OpenAI employees because we believe in the mission of doing this not for profit. Because if that was true, they got $10 billion from Microsoft to run all their stuff, and they've got 700 loyal employees who want it to be nonprofit, and they got one obnoxious CEO who wants to make a product out of it. But that wasn't the situation. Turns out they had 500 employees who wanted to do what the CEO did, and that is a big miscalculation. Like, maybe the OpenAI board thought, this is going to work. All our employees believe in our mission. That's why when you do those net promoter score surveys at work, Marco doesn't know about these.
No, nope. Oh, yeah.
I'm saying, like, do you, that's for clients. But anyway, for internally, like, do you believe in the mission of OpenAI? People are like, oh, yes, totally. When push comes to shove, they believe in making money and getting rich.
Yeah. And again, the reality is just when you have that many employees, a lot of them are going to be paid in stock or some kind of stock based thing where, like, the company, if the company does well commercially, you make more money. That's really hard for all those employees to say no to. That's the thing. Like, whatever their ambitions are or were about being a nonprofit and everything, again, that is laudable, and the world needs more of that. But this, the cards were stacked so hard against them to achieve that here, because what they were sitting on is such a gold mine that it's just impossible to sustain that in the environment around them. And once they, got in with Microsoft, I think that pretty much was sealing the deal. Okay, this is the direction you're going to go now.
They needed to do that. Like, they couldn't pursue their goal of trying to make HAL 9000 without tons and tons of money, and they were not able to raise it on their own. They couldn't get people to say, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like a type of thing where you can just do, like, one quiet person alone at their personal computer is going to have this amazing breakthrough. Like, the current approach to solving this problem requires massive amounts of computing, which requires massive amounts of money. And you're really going to be stymied in the attempt to achieve your goal if you just don't have enough money. I think they raised like $130 million or something, and Microsoft gave them $10 billion. They weren't even close.
Yeah, like that. There was no way that the nonprofit side of their leadership, like, that side was inevitably going to lose. And the only question now is how and when. I think they just did, frankly. And I think it's only a very short matter of time, possibly tonight, But it's a very short matter of time before that entire part of the company, including the board, is cleared out and replaced.
Yeah, and it's not even clear to me. I know that OpenAI is viewed as the leader in this area, but they're not the only company doing large language models. Like everybody's got one. Facebook's got one. Apple reportedly has one. Google's got one. Like, you know, like everyone is working on this technology. It is not like a secret sauce that only OpenAI has. Maybe they're the best at it. Maybe they were there first. Maybe they have advancements we don't know about. But it's a type of thing that, you know, is kind of like, you know, so the iPhone is the best phone, but Android phones exist. It's not like Apple is the only company in the world to have a touchscreen smartphone. It is a thing that exists in the industry. And that's a hard choice because it's a platform type thing. But like anything, like SSDs, everybody's got SSDs. It's not one company that says, oh, Apple's laptops are better because they don't have spinning hard drives and everyone else does. No, everybody has SSDs. Just who has the best SSDs. Like these large language models are so useful and so widespread. And the fact that OpenAI, especially in the beginning of their nonprofit existence, shared all their technology with the world. They shared their discoveries. Like that was part of their charter and their mission statement. Everyone's more or less on the same page with these things. They're useful technology. Everyone is thinking of new ways that they can use them in their existing products and make new products that they weren't able to make before with this new technology. Whatever happens to OpenAI, that's going to happen. Right. Which is the other absurd thing about the board saying we want to keep this purity of nonprofit. Like even if all of your employees and Sam Altman agree with you, the whole rest of the industry is taking this ball and running with it because it's a useful technology that you can make money with. And so they're sticking it in everything. Will it go beyond that? Will it like, you know, the future of these type of things, will they just get better and better until they're practically hell 9,000? We'll see. Right now they're not, but they're useful. They're useful right now. And so everyone wants to have access to them. And if OpenAI disappeared from existence, the rest of the industry would continue forward with, you know, making fancy code autocomplete in Xcode 16, for example, right? That's going to happen with or without OpenAI, right? But HAL 9000, I don't know if there are any other companies with anything close to access to the resources that OpenAI has that are attempting to do that. Part of the fear of the OpenAI board is it's just going to happen accidentally, and so we better do it deliberately so we can do it right. I don't think it's going to happen accidentally any more than self-driving cars are going to happen accidentally, but we'll see.
All right. Do we want to go to Ask ATP? Do we want to keep going here? How do you want to handle this?
We can do Ask ATP. Actually, what can we? Nah, the RCOS one is too big. I'll save it next week, I guess.
Good talk.
Yeah, all I right. think we have to go Ask ATP.
Yeah.
All right. Goodbye, future Marco. Let's do some Ask ATP. Tim Schmitz writes, what's the story with ECC RAM in the Apple Silicon era? I remember it being important to some folks on Intel, but I haven't heard much about it lately. Is it not applicable or relevant on Apple Silicon? If so, why? John, would you mind giving us a quick rehash as to what ECC RAM is and then answer Tim's question, please?
ECC, that stands for Error Correcting Code, is a technology used in RAM chips that will account for errors in the memory and be able to correct them if the errors are small enough. So RAM chips, they're not perfect. They're tiny little analog electronic devices. What you would hope is that you would write some bits to one location, and when you read it later, you get the exact same bits back that you wrote there. That's how it's supposed to work. But sometimes you'll read, and one of those bits will be wrong, or maybe two of the bits will be wrong. And why? Well, you know, electrical issues with the manufacturing of the chips, cosmic rays, all sorts of things can go wrong. And you would think, who cares if one bit is flipped here or there? But as RAM sizes have increased, the odds of finding one of those one or two bit errors has increased as well. Because if you find, oh, that's going to be one in a million, how many bits do you think are there in RAM? Back when you had 8 kilobytes of RAM, there weren't as many bits as when you have 128 gigabytes of RAM. So how many errors are there? More than you might think. So as RAM sizes have increased, one of the technologies that was introduced on really important computers is ECC, where they say, okay, we store some extra information, which costs money because like, you're storing more information. And with that extra information, we can tell when one of the bits is not what it's supposed to be. And in fact, sometimes we store enough information that we can tell what it was supposed to be and we can fix it and change it back. And so your RAM gives the correct results, unlike Casey's third-party RAM in his iMac. And the kind of computers that would do that were expensive server computers that people would, you know, run important stuff on, like financial things or banking transactions or basically server hardware. Server hardware would have ECC RAM because it's really important that the contents of RAM be correct. The consequences of even a single bit being flipped could cause a security problem or a crash or something else that you don't want to happen. because it's a hardware failure. Back in the day when the Mac Pro was a little bit more pro, it came with ECC RAM because Intel Xeon CPUs were their sort of server class CPUs, and they supported ECC RAM, and Apple would buy, you know, the CPUs from Intel, and they would get motherboard chipsets from Intel, and they would support ECC RAM, and they would put that on their Mac Pro motherboards. These days, we know what the situation with the Mac Pro is. It is very much like a Mac Mini in a much, 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 much bigger case with some extra stuff thrown in there. These days, Apple does not do as many things to differentiate the Mac Pro from the less expensive and vastly smaller computers. As in, they're not designing entirely different RAM, entirely different SoC, entirely different anything really for the Mac Pro except the big case and some PCI Express stuff, right? The parallel story here is, and I don't know the details on this, but as RAM has advanced over the years, a lot of the new RAM designs necessarily incorporated a technology much like ECC just to function correctly, because they would have, you know, various arrangements of bits or speed enhancements or whatever, that they would incorporate some kind of error correction within just the regular functioning of the RAM. And you wouldn't call it ECC RAM, you just call it DDR4 or whatever. But if you were looked at like what's inside DDR4 RAM, you'd find some parts of the circuitry that are there to try to detect and or correct errors. That leads us to the question of ECC RAM in Macs today. Is this something that Apple should have in their Mac Pros and don't? Is it, do all Macs with the unified memory architecture where the ARM chips have ECC RAM? I would say that much like the keyboards and everything having to do with the Mac Pro, the situation is this. Apple could spend more money to essentially make RAM that is more resilient to errors in the Mac Pro, and only in the Mac Pro, because that is the model that costs the most and it's where it's most important that you not have any bit flip errors. Apple does not do that. So yeah, could it benefit from it? Yes, it could. It would cost more money and it would be better. Would it be better in a way that anybody would care about? I'm not sure. Because again, I think the RAM that they do use, like, what is the reliability of that RAM compared to the ECC RAM that was in the old Intel Mac Pros? Like, in absolute numbers, not in terms of, like, well, that the back then, the ECC RAM was better than regular RAM. Today, again, more expensive RAM with more complicated error correcting would be better than RAM without it. But in absolute values, are a bit flip errors in the M2 Ultra more of a problem than they were on a Xeon with ECC RAM? I don't know. So I would follow some of the category of, if they offered it, I would like it and think it's good. And practically speaking, especially back in the old days, ECC RAM did provide better reliability than that same amount of RAM that wasn't ECC. So, you know, if you're wondering why did my computer have some random crash sometime, again, ask Casey about this. Was it because you had some kind of problem with the RAM and would it have been prevented from ECC? Hard to say, but maybe. Like, there's a reason they sold it on all those server chips for a long time. And if you had a server that didn't have ECC and data center next to one that did, and you had enough of them, you could see the difference in the reliability of, you know, across hundreds and hundreds of servers of ECC versus non-ECC. Like, people weren't paying extra for that ECC RAM just for the hell of it. It actually did provide a benefit. So I think it is applicable. I think it is relevant to Apple Silicon. And I think we're never going to get it in the Mac Pro. So don't hold your breath.
Womp womp. Chris Gleim writes, I've undertaken the task of photographing my son's art, he just turned 5, to replace my previous strategy, which was throwing it in a cardboard box in the storage room and forgetting about it for years. Ideally, I will only keep a few of these items and toss the rest, and I'm planning to make a photo book for the grandparents for Christmas. Thankfully, I was able to borrow some lighting equipment from work, and I have a decent camera. I was wondering if you all had a strategy for this. My strategy is, generally speaking, throwing it in a cardboard box in the storage room and forgetting about it for years. So no, I have no good answers for this, unfortunately.
Yeah,
Marco,
do
you have anything?
No, I mean, for the most part, most of my kids' art that is really, you know, that was like when he was old enough to care and put, you know, time into it, most of that has actually been in the digital realm. Like, he's had an iPad for a while, and my wife is really artistic and introduced him early on to Procreate, which is this, you know, this iPad drawing app that everybody uses. And he does a lot in there. And so most of what he has, like, artistically is either like stuff on, you know, pieces of paper that are easy to store in different places, not a lot of like three-dimensional stuff, or drawings in Procreate on iOS, which of course, you know, we back up and everything. So I don't really have this problem as much as many parents do, just because my kids' art format is more easily storable.
John?
My strategy is to take photographs of art so I can get rid of it, because we have the same situation, just boxes and boxes of the stuff. For the most part, I just take iPhone pictures. Like, it's really, especially with just like rumbly kid artwork on construction paper with glue and the corners are curling, like this, not, you know, Chris sent in a picture of like, he had like a lighting set up and it's big. I'm just like, put it down on someplace with good sunlight on the floor and take pictures of it with my iPhone. Cause that's all I want. Like, these are not great works of art that I need to preserve for future generations. Just don't remember. Oh, I remember that thing that he made. And I look at the pictures to make sure they're clear and not blurry and I can see all the things. And if there's one that I really, really cared about, I could square up the edges and put it in Photoshop and, you know, try to fix the shadows of the curling corners and do all that stuff. But I think the main goal is kind of like, scanning the digital photos or negatives, get it out of the physical realm and into the digital ASAP. And then you just can't hold on to that stuff. Kids make a lot of drawings. So like, you don't want to throw it away and never see it again, but just, you know, use your iPhone, take a picture and then get rid of it.
Yeah. I think it's also important to kind of distinguish like a lot of kid art that comes home from school. What, you know, depending on your kid, of course, you know, in my case, a lot of times it was very easy to see like, okay, the teacher told him to do this. And you know, whatever came home was not really a work by him. It was a work by the teacher's lesson plan. And that's fine. There's a place for that. But it was very obvious when he had made something that he really cared about, rather than just follow the template the teacher set out for everybody. And so for, you know, for the follow the template stuff, he didn't care about it. And so we didn't have to care about it, you know, and like, our level of care would ramp up with his level of care and involvement. And so when he was doing something like on his own, you know, of his own accord with his own direction, that stuff is significantly better and worth keeping. And there's way less of that as a kid goes through school compared to template stuff that, you know, everyone did.
Yeah, and there's a hierarchy. Like, the other thing you should do with them, aside from taking a picture and throwing it out, take the really good ones and frame them. We have a bunch of select things from various points in our kids' lives that are in frames hanging on the wall. That's another way to preserve them. Also take digital pictures of those, by the way. But, you know, you get rid of most of it. You take a little extra care to take photos of the gems, and then the really good ones, put in frames, put up around your house.
Jamie West writes, do you think the use of technology actually makes your lives easier, or if you do it because it's more of a hobby? These days, I try to have as little technology in my home as I can. I have regular light switches that make the lights go on and off, and I don't have any home automations of any kind. I don't notice my life being appreciatively worse because of this. In fact, since reducing the use of technology, my life has become consistently calmer and more stress-free. The same is true for my computer these days. Time was, my menu bar would be filled with stats and custom functionality. Are we sure this wasn't John writing this? Along with custom icons and the Finder and automation scripts, all of which required ongoing maintenance and updating. Now I have a pretty vanilla installation of macOS. My second sideline career of being an author, I only really hit my stride productivity-wise when I got rid of all the complicated software and decided to just use a plain and simple text editor. Maybe I just like the simple life, and these days I only use as much technology as I need. But I'm interested to know where the trade-off lies for you with the added minor stresses that come with incorporating and maintaining technology in your home life. Do you only use technology which makes your life genuinely easier or better? Or is there a part of you that convinces yourself it's useful because tinkering with tech is a bit of a hobby and you find it fun to do? I understand where Jamie's coming from here. I think for me, it's both. I think unquestionably it's a hobby. Like, one does not come up with a 3 Raspberry Pi solution to knowing whether or not your garage door is open if it isn't a hobby. Like, that is just straight up lunacy, right? But knowing when the garage door is open does indeed make my life better. So it's a little of both. I don't have a lot of automations. In fact, I just went on Automators just a couple of, I think it was probably a month ago now, and talked about some of the automations I have. And I don't really have that much, but the ones I have, I genuinely do think make my life better. Would I be fine without them? Of course, I'd be just fine without them, but they do make my life a little bit better. And I like that. And And again, so much of this, though, is I like the certain kinds of tinkering. I like certain kinds of projects and stuff like that. And yeah, this is certainly a hobby. And ultimately, when I come up with a solution for something, even if it's just, you know, an out of the box solution, as I have been espousing for a little over a year now, and Marco is now starting to join me, one of us, you know, when you have your Sonos playing the same music in an uninterrupted way and without any sort of latency across your entire house, including your backyard, that's pretty rad. And granted, that's not as much tinkering as it is spending a copious amount of money, but nevertheless, that does make my life better. That is tech that makes my life better. So I see it definitely as a lot of column A and a lot of column B, but that's where I come down on it. I don't know, Marco, where do you land?
I think it depends a lot on the role of technology in your life. Are you an enthusiast about technology and you want to explore stuff like that, or are you using it more as a tool to get your job done? And your job might be something else, or something that the technology is only playing an assistive role in. And this changes at different points in people's lives and for different reasons. You know, for me, when I was younger, especially like, you know, my like high school and college days, I was much more of a tinkerer. And I would spend a lot more of my time, especially on the software side, a lot more of my time like messing with my, you know, I didn't have a menu bar yet because I was on Windows, but, you know, messing with my Windows setup and installing a bunch of different system utilities and doing up a whole bunch of power user stuff, like tweaking things and, you know, messing around with the registry and making my start button say Marco and stuff like I all sorts of that kind of tinkering stuff that you do, especially as a young person, because back then my priorities were, well, you know, try to get a girlfriend, but that wasn't going so well. So instead, I guess spend as much time on my computer as possible. And so I was using the computer back then for the sake of using the computer. Like, that was the activity. The activity I was spending most of my time on was messing around on my computer. And
actually, to interrupt quickly, because yeah. I was very much in the same boat, a lot of the tinkering was finding an excuse. And I think this is what you're driving at, but finding an excuse to need more time on the computer. Like, oh, I don't really need my start button to say Marco, but if I wanted to figure out how to do that, that's more time I can spend using this thing, which is both a toy and a hobby and everything to me. You know, like I probably speak for Marco and actually probably John as well in saying that the computer was like everything to me when I was young, because there was just limitless opportunity to do anything there. In a way that I think is both there today and is very, very different today. But finding all these things to tinker with was, in no small part for me anyway, giving me reasons to continue to sit at the computer.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Me too. Like, my activity for the day would be, I'm going to sit at my computer and I'll find stuff to do. You know? Mm-hmm. And largely today, I actually still largely do that. I just have more things that I need to do that are at the computer, and I have more things in my life that break up those times so that I have less time at the computer than I used to. But you know, as you go through life, your priorities change, your needs change, and for the most part, most people do some degree of specialization. You know, you specialize in some part of your career or your hobby life or your family life or whatever, and that necessitates having less time spent messing around with stuff like this. And so, you know, and some people, they make the messing around their career. To some degree, we do that here by being on a tech podcast. Although, you know, you mentioned like, you know, automators and like other shows where there are people who go way more in depth with that side of things than we ever do. And they've kind of made that a part of their career. So in some ways for them, it's both work and play. You know, the same way, like for us, you know, buying new Macs is both work and play. But, you know, for me personally, as I have, you know, gone through a career and adulthood and adult responsibilities and family responsibilities, my tolerance for tech that requires a lot of tinkering has gone down over time. And that happens to a lot of people, you know, like oftentimes, like, you know, you find yourself trading money for time, you know, which is the opposite of, you know, when you're in college, you have no money and tons of time. And, you know, as you get older, a lot of times you're like, you know what, rather than figure out how to hack myself into not needing this extra terabyte of disk space, I'm just going to buy the one with a terabyte more of disk space, you know, because your trade-off is different at that point in your life. And for me, most of, like, for what I'm doing this part of my life, there are some areas that I'm still willing to do some degree of, like, technological tinkering. For instance, I mentioned a few episodes ago, I've been burning these you know, Blu-ray 100 gig M disk things for archiving data. I'm still doing that. I've burned 26 of them so far. I have my entire photo library, Tiff's entire photo library, and now my entire music library all backed up on these really weird discs. It took forever. So there are certain areas like that I will try, partly for show content to talk about here, partly because I'm just interested in them. But my tolerance for tech that doesn't work very well or that requires lots of messing with is down to almost zero. So, for instance, smart home stuff is a great example that Jamie brought up, and this is such a great example. Smart home stuff leaves you infinite potential for tinkering, but most of it really doesn't work very well. Or it'll work for, like, a few weeks, and then something will change or break, and then you got to, like, redo everything to make it ever work again. Or you have to add these different, like, you know, bridging and hacking projects or, you know, tricks to get this thing to talk to that thing and then involve this web service so that this thing can bounce things off the web service and send this thing and this other thing. Like, that's where you lose me. Like, once you get into that stuff, that's where you lose me. Because that doesn't make things better for me. But for a lot of people, they are on a different part of that, you know, of that trade-off continuum of, like, do you want to spend time tinkering or do you want to spend time, you know, just having stuff work for you and not messing with it? So for everyone, it's different. But as I said, for me, I'm closer now to I just need things to work because I need to make time for the parts of my computing life that are more important to me so that when I do get that precious time sitting in front of the computer where I don't have a different obligation that I must be doing at that moment, I'm able to do the things I really want to do. Like work on Overcast, like, you know, like deep programming work, or really creative work. Like that's what I want to make time to do. And the more I have to mess with my technology, the less time I have for those higher priority things.
John?
Yeah, so asking three programmers on a tech podcast is probably going to give you a different answer than the rest of the population. But yeah, for me, tech has been my hobby, obviously, since early childhood. It's also an area of interest, which I think is different than a hobby, because when people hear hobby, they're like, oh, it's a thing that you're doing. It's an interest of mine as well, kind of in the same way that, like, cars are. Like, I spend all this time reading about cars that I'm never going to own, and a lot of them I'll never even see in person. It's like, is your hobby cars or, like, all these car rebuilding videos? Are you working on cars? No, I'm never doing any of that, but I'm interested in it. I find it interesting. It is an interest of mine. So a lot of the tech stuff that I'm into, it's an interest. Even if I'm never going to do it, I'm interested in it. I want to learn about it. I want to know about it. I find it interesting. So it is more than just a hobby. And then, of course, it was my profession as well. And not in the way that, like, you use a computer to help you do your job. Computers were the job, right? It's kind of like being a builder. And you build a hospital. It's like, oh, you really super into hospitals? Like, no, I'm a builder. I build things. And then you build a fire station. Oh, I guess you really love fire stations? It's like, no, I'm a builder. I'll build anything. I like the task of building. Well, I was a computer programmer. And yes, I was a web dev. So it was more narrow than just being a builder. But, like, I built so many different things with web technology, depending on what company I was working for. So my job was wrangling the computers, right? The computers were a profession directly. Not that I'm using a computer to write a novel and I'm a novelist. I'm literally wrangling the computers for you. And it's my hobby and it's my interest. So as you can imagine, the balance in my life about trade-offs for technology was massively tilted towards the tech side. And the way that manifests in daily life and sort of home life is, for somebody like me, and I imagine Marco Casey as well, the personal payoff of getting something set up the way you want it, finally got my Emacs set up the way I want it, you know, the personal payoff of getting the 3 Raspberry Pi solution or whatever, for people like us, very often balances the amount of tinkering required to get there. Even Marco says he doesn't want to deal with a lot of stuff. He does deal with a lot of stuff, even if it's just buying and returning products and getting them set up and seeing how they work, right? There is some amount of tinkering and engaging in that hobby. And the reward is when you come in and it's finally set up the way you want and the music plays the way you want and you use the voice command, the lights go on and the automatic thermostat does all the things, you get a level of satisfaction out of that. And if you are in a house with people who are not exactly like you in that regard, you have something to compare it to, which is, yeah, they like it fine when like the lights work and you can watch stuff on the TV. But you're over there going, see, did you see how well that worked? Like, they didn't do any of the work to set it up. And the amount of satisfaction they're getting out of this, you know, pristine 4K television signal going to your fancy TV that you researched, they're like, oh, I guess TV works. Right? They didn't even have to do the work. And they like their scales, it takes so little to unbalance their scales. That TV doesn't work one time. This is garbage. I hate everything that you've done here. Get rid of it, right? And we're willing to like put in hours and hours of like buying products and hooking them up and doing all this stuff or whatever. We want to get that satisfaction. Like, now it's finally working the way I want. Even in market case, it finally works without me having to deal with it, right? You put in effort to get to that goal. No one else, even though that no one else is asked to put in any of that effort. So if there's any downside whatsoever, they're like, oh, scale's unbalanced. I don't like this. Right? I just want the light switches to work. If the lights don't turn on one time, even though they put in zero amount of effort to make this home automation, it's like, nope. And every time lights do come on, do you think they're getting some amazing satisfaction of knowing the giant Rube Goldberg machine that you put together to make that happen? Nope. They just want the lights to work. And so everyone has to balance that differently. And I think maybe the key to at least family happiness within a household is to realize that if it is your hobby, your interest, your profession, or God forbid, all three, your satisfaction when everything comes together is not experienced by other people. And so the second something doesn't work, they will give it a thumbs down. And when it does work, they will think nothing of it. And yep. So keep that in mind when trying to balance, like, is it a benefit to your life or is it like a hindrance? You're not the only one. If you're living with other people, you're not the only one who's in play here. You have to think about how it's affecting everybody else's life. And by the way, as you know, if they're unhappy, you're probably also going to be unhappy. So it's not as if you can say, well, I'm satisfied with it, with this trade-off or whatever. If everyone else in the house hates it, you will eventually not be satisfied with that trade-off. So self-reflection is the right approach, including, you know, being true to yourself and knowing I do like this stuff. I am interested in it. Like Casey's part, he wants to do it for the sake of doing it. And it's fun. And he feels a sense of accomplishment when he's done. And he has to realize that's a him thing. That is not a rest of the house thing. And let people have hobbies. Like, let enjoy your interests. That's what life is all about. You know, just like if you have hobbies and interests, engage in them in a constructive way and get as much enjoyment out of it as you can. And hopefully you enjoy your work and hopefully you're doing something in your profession that is also something that you enjoy or at least have some kind of interest in. But be aware that other people have different opinions about the thrill they get when it works and the feeling they get when it doesn't work.
Thanks to our sponsor this week, Squarespace. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week. So, did we order our IE pins yet?
Yeah, totally.
Are they accepting orders?
Yes. Yeah. So, here's what happened. So a couple episodes ago, right before we recorded, The Verge got the leak of most of the details about the Humane AI pin that was about to be unveiled. We did our episode. We talked a little bit about our impressions of just seeing the Verge leak. And we were like, well, you know, we don't want to judge it too much because we don't know their side of the story yet. Let's see what happens when they officially unveil it. Then the next day, they officially unveiled it with this really odd video and open up pre-orders. And then what happened in the meantime is pre-orders opened up. No one noticed. And then all this stuff blew up with OpenAI. A few days later. And so it seemed to breeze by without much mention. And I think if I had to guess, I think Humane's chance in the press is already over. But I thought it might be interesting to just talk about a little more because we did get more details about the Humane AI Pin product, you know, their first product. And this is, you know, it's kind of a, it's a noteworthy thing, but I think it's interesting. The era of technology that we are in, all of this drama around OpenAI has gotten way more attention and is way more interesting to the tech press than a launch of a pretty hyped device that's a whole new device type from a whole bunch of ex-Apple people. Like that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that would have been way more headline grabbing than it ends up that it has been, and way more relevant, I think, to the modern tech world than it will probably end up being. So I think that's interesting by itself, but also just kind of looking at the Humane product, now that we know all the details about it, you know, or at least, you know, whatever they have chosen to show so far, which seems like pretty much everything. What if anything is different now that they've unveiled it? Basically everything The Verge said was correct. But now we just have more details about what some of its features are, how some of these features work. We see like the laser thing that, you know, don't call it a screen. We see how Humane is positioning it, what they want it to be. You know, it has all these like, you know, basically it's kind of like wearing an Amazon Echo on your chest that, you know, happens to have a few extra features. You know, so I gotta say the video, and again, the video was really weird. And I'm just gonna set that aside and just focus on the product because the video didn't do them any favors, I don't think. But at least we see what they're going for. We see here's this thing that you're going to wear as this, basically as this badge on your chest that you tap and ask it to do things. It can play music for you. It can answer questions for you, sometimes correctly. It can take pictures for you with a camera that faces front, like a body cam if you're a cop, like it's that, like that kind of perspective. There's a whole bunch of interesting ideas here. I don't think this is going to go well. I would honestly kind of be surprised if they made it to their launch day. They're taking pre-orders now, and they say estimated delivery early 2024. But I would be surprised if they're getting any pre-orders that aren't just from like gadget reviewers. And even then, I don't think it's going to be that big of a number. but anyway, I think it's interesting. You know, when you look at this product, there are a lot of interesting ideas. It's definitely going to flop, and I think it's going to flop because they seem to have, how do I put it? I mean, they seem to have gone for an ideal physical environment that doesn't really exist for a lot of people, based on tech features that really aren't ready yet. Or in some cases, they pulled off technology that is cool, but is not actually better than what they are trying to replace. So, for instance, the physical challenges. As discussed last time, this is like a pin that attaches to your clothing, has magnetic backs to hold it on and charge it. I mean, okay. What if I don't want this giant thing on the front of my shirt? It's pretty big. It's pretty noticeable. It's not like a little tiny like enamel pin. It's a big, you know, badge sized pin. It is very, you know, it is not discreet at all. Like anyone would see this, like, and anyone who doesn't know what this is would definitely ask you about it. What the heck is that? What it's on your shirt? Like, so there's that angle of it. There's the reality that it weighs about as much as two AA batteries, which is not heavy, but not light. And imagine that just like flopping around in your chest all day. Like that would actually be noticeable and that would be kind of annoying. If you're wearing any kind of lightweight clothing, that's going to be very noticeable. Suppose it's a season and you want to go outside and put a jacket on or a hoodie or something. Do you have to not have the features of this thing during that time? Or do you take it off your shirt and move it to your jacket? Every time you add or remove a layer of clothing, it's going to be a problem with this kind of device. Like, Okay.
Well, but Marco, I don't understand why you would say that that would be an issue. I mean, first of all, how could they possibly know, a company based in the greater San Francisco area, how could they possibly know anything about putting on and off layers? I mean, that's not something that happens in San Francisco ever.
I know. It's like how, and the, again, it's, and even just the whole concept of like, I hate my phone so much that I'm going to wear this thing and use it instead of a phone in many cases for things that really a phone would be better at. But the environment that they want to use this in, it's like, I don't want to be talking to something constantly out in the world. I barely even want to do it in my own house. Like, the idea that it is a voice-first interface, I find optimistic, but not super compelling for most realities that most people live in. They also try to replace the screen. This is a screenless device, kind of, but it does have that laser projecting thing that can project a screen onto your hand. And, you know, they don't call it a screen, but I got news for you. That's a screen. Like, that's just a really weird, crappy screen that is very limited and
excuse
a little bit
me,
difficult
sir.
To use.
Excuse me, it is a laser ink display. Thank you very much.
But yeah, like, and like, that's, again, that's kind of cool tech for something. Like, I'm sure there's good uses for that. But like, when it showed it in the video, I was like, oh, you're just navigating a screen. It just happens to be projected onto your hand and you got to tilt your hand in weird ways to interact with it. But that's just a screen. It's just like, you know, what John always brings up. Like, when I tried to have my magazine app that didn't have a settings screen, and it ends up, I just kind of had to shove settings everywhere, and it was a worse design, and I ended up just having to make a settings screen. In this case, like, navigating this device, what they were showing in the video, it's, they're using a device with a screen. It's just a really unusual kind of screen, but they are still navigating it like a screen and using it like a screen. And it turns out you need a screen for a lot of these things. And if you're going to have a screen, just use your phone. It's way better. Like, that's, so there's all that to contend with. And so I think they have a lot of physical challenges to this, that like, there is just physically speaking, I don't see any reason why this is better than a phone and a watch. Like, for all of the like kind of ambient availability that they have on it, it should be a watch, because a watch is physically a much easier and more versatile thing that can work for more people in more conditions than this. And even then, it's like, but I mean, this is not that different from what a phone does, and a phone is better at all these things, and you already have a phone. But I also think what's interesting is that the ecosystem realities of the modern technological world is like, even if this was a great idea that was very well executed and that everybody would want, the reality is they're trying to have this replace your phone in a lot of key roles, including things like, it has its own phone number that they want people to call this and to message this. Okay. So you're going to give people a whole new number just for your AI PIN? Or are you going to move your number to it and then not have that number on your phone? Are people supposed to text this, and then it's just going to read you a summary of your friend's text messages? Like, hey, you know what? I don't actually want to read my friend's text messages. Just summarize them for me. Like, there are so many parts about this that it makes for a cool 2-second demo. But if you think about it for another 2 seconds, you're like, oh, wait a minute, though. But what about this? Or wait, wouldn't this fail in this one way? Or wouldn't this have this major shortcoming? But I think it's interesting that, like, because of the ecosystem realities of, you know, our tech world today, because this is trying to replace your phone, it has no chance whatsoever. Because who is going to buy this to replace their phone if it's not going to sync all this stuff back to their phone? Like, it's not going to have iMessage support. So you're going to become a green bubble friend, and it's going to sync to nothing. You're going to have, like, none of your messages that come to your AI PIN are going to appear in your phone's messaging app, because it doesn't work that way. You have to have this different phone number for it. Maybe you could do some kind of forwarding tricks, but, like, who's going to do that? So it's interesting that, like, the modern, Apple and Google duopoly here, there's actually not that much room for a startup like this to come in and make their own thing. Because it, unless it works really, really well and is very, very integrated with either iOS or Android, something like this is not going to get off the ground, which is kind of a shame. Like, honestly, again, I don't think this is a very compelling product, honestly. But suppose it was, it still would fail because of that massive hardware lock-in environment that we are in now with these modern platforms. And that's kind of a shame. But ultimately, honestly, I don't think this is what Humane originally intended to launch. The Humane company and the massive like talent drain they did from Apple and all the work they've been doing greatly predates the rise of what we're calling AI today. That the you know what we're calling AI today is a very recent thing. Humane's been in development for longer than that. So I think what probably happened is they were probably planning something else, or at least a very different focus for this product. It wasn't working out so well. They started running out of money, maybe, or running out of time, and they kind of pivoted recently to be like, hey, you know what, let's make it really AI focused. That way that'll get more attention, it'll fit the current market better. I mean, maybe it'll help us raise more money or whatever. So I think there's a more complicated story here, but basically this product doesn't even seem like what they originally set out to make, and also it doesn't seem like it's going to succeed at all. So frankly, again, I would be surprised if it ships. I think the company might go under and get bought, you know, for acquihire or whatever, before this even ships. And if it does ship,
for a while,
I don't think it's going to last long.
I talked about this for a while in the upcoming episode of Rectifs, so I won't repeat too much of what I said there if you want to hear me talk about it for a little bit longer with Merlin. But yeah, this thing, it's kind of hard to tell when they talk about it, whether they really believe this wrongheaded idea of replacing people's phones, as in like any moment you spend on your phone is bad. And so to the degree that we can reduce that or replace it, our product is good. Like this kind of value judgment, this is that, you know, for, you know, everything that we can help you do with your little badge, that's a win because it's time you didn't spend on your phone. And that's why it's good, because phone is bad and this is good, right? I can't tell if they really believe that. I kind of think maybe they do. And that's what makes you think this is actually kind of the product they wanted to make, which is essentially get off those screens, kids, and don't look at screens and just have a thing that's a badge. And I think the AI stuff coming along was like, wow, this is a great boon for us, because we were already going down this path of like screens bad, project light onto your hand instead and talk to your badge. And now we can do it even better, right? But it's hard for me to really like, if they really did believe that, it's like, really? Did these smart people all really buy into that thing? Maybe they had a very charismatic leader who really believed in that or something. The flip side of that is what you just alluded to and what I mostly spent all of Rectifs talking about, the platform problem. A product like this, essentially an Amazon Echo that, you know, a smarter Amazon Echo that you pin on your clothing that you can talk to and that has a camera that faces out or whatever, great idea. Unfortunately, you cannot make that product without deep integration with Android or iOS. And the only companies that can have that kind of deep integration with Android or iOS are companies that are currently heavily entrenched in that. Either Google, because they make Android, or a very big Google phone maker like Samsung or whatever, or of course, Apple. Humane out here cannot have the integration they need with the iPhone and iOS to make a good version of their little badgy product, because Apple doesn't allow it, because their platform does not allow things like this to happen. And Rectifs, the example I gave was Quicksilver. We ended up talking about like quick, you know, command space things that you type or whatever. macOS was able to, and continues to be able to, support things like this. A system integrated extension that starts to become part of the way you use your computer, that the person who made that computer and the operating system didn't foresee, but that becomes like, that is like deeply entrenched, hitting command space. I know Spotlight exists, but before Spotlight exists, there was things like Quicksilver and Launch Bar and stuff like that, right? What we would call a system extension. The things that the AI pin would have to do would have to make it like a system extension. It's the same reason we can't replace Siri with something better. The same reason we can't replace reminders. It's like the iPhone ecosystem is too closed to support innovation like this unless it comes from Apple. That is the, when you're saying this is a shame, Marco, that is the biggest shame of it, is that Apple's control of this platform does not allow innovations like this to be successful. The only company that could do a pin like that, well, is Apple on the iPhone, right? And on Android, it's a little bit better, but not much, because Google really controls that platform very well, and there's a small number of Android phone makers that have the wherewithal to do their own software stacks and that kind of integration, right? And by the way, if you do something that Google doesn't like, they're not going to let you in the Play Store, and then you get, you know, it's... These platforms are not as open as the personal computer and the Macs were, right? Because on there are so many things that we continue to do to this day. Even as locked down as the Mac is today, there are so many things that you can, that a third party can do to enhance the way a Mac works at a system level that feels part of the system, that allows innovation, that yes, eventually the platform owner copies, like, oh, someone made a menu bar, a clock in the menu bar. Eventually Apple's going to put that into the operating system. But that's how things advance. And iOS, it's like, run your little apps in your little sandbox in your little world and get your little, you know, Squirkle, right? But don't you dare mess with any other part of the system. We control notifications. We control the status bar. We control the default, the web browser, the AI agent that's installed, the default mapping thing. And like, to the degree that Apple slowly opens that stuff up, they're so far from allowing something like the Humane Pin to work. So I feel for the company. And that's why I think, did you make this because you think this is the best thing to do? Or did you make it like this because you have no choice? It has to have its own phone number. It can't sync. It can't use iMessage. Like, it can't share. Like, you have no choice but to do this. You have no choice to at least try to be standalone, because Apple doesn't want you. It won't let you integrate in the way that you want, right? You'd want to be able to just talk to it and have it do things on your phone when you talk to it and have a tight connection. But Apple can barely make a tight connection between their own watch and their phone, for crying out loud, let alone letting third parties do it. So, I can't tell if this company thinks this is actually a good idea and phones are evil, or they just see the reality that's like, if we have no choice, we have to pretend that we are replacing the phone. We have to be as standalone as possible. We have to get our own phone number. We have to have our own world with our own contacts and our own messaging. And, you know, it's just, and that's never going to fly, even if you did everything great and it seems like they didn't. And then there's the problems we talked about last week of like they're assembling a bunch of disparate parts into a whole that they hope is greater than the sum of that parts. I don't think it is. And I think a lot of that parts don't work right yet.
Yeah. And
I agree.
I agree.
And I also vehemently agree that it's going to flop. Like, I will be flabbergasted if this really gets any traction whatsoever. In fact, I would be surprised if it gets as much traction as Google Glass got. And yes,
I hope it does get to the point where tech reviewers review it, because I want to read those reviews.
Yeah, agreed. But I do think there are some very clever and interesting ideas here. I really am extremely put off by voice being the only real interaction model. Like, yes, there's the laser ink display or whatever, but effectively it's just voice. And I really don't like that at all. Like, I would much rather type than speak almost any time. And maybe that makes me an old, I don't know. I don't think that's,
but what would you type on?
Well, like,
eventually they end up making a phone, right? And we know they can't, right? Oh, well, maybe they just have an app on iOS. And then you get back to the integration problem. Okay, so you've got a hardware device and you've got an app on iOS. How well do they integrate with each other? Is your app running all the time? Can they communicate easily all the time? Or is it, it's just, you have to fit within this little walls that Apple makes. So here's what apps are allowed to do. And here's what hardware accessories are allowed to do. And here's when they're allowed to talk to each other and how much and through what means. And it's so terrible.
I agree with you. But like, as an example, one of the things they demoed in their very funny video, which, by the way, it's like 10 minutes and it is worth
watching.
Seems
longer.
Because
it
seem longer, but it is so weird. And Imran, or whatever his name is,
yeah,
that's the head. I think for like the TED talk he did way back when, his like kind of, I don't know if aloof is the word I'm looking for, but his kind of like chill, I don't really care what's going on right now vibe, I think that did work for the TED talk. But for the product video, it did not land well, and it is worth spending the 10 minutes watching this thing because
it looks a little
else. Sleepy,
right? High energy.
The whole video,
no,
it's,
certainly not.
It's like, do you, like, I understand that's just his vibe, but like, the whole video, it's like there is no enthusiasm about this product being displayed whatsoever.
Yep. No, it's very true. So all that aside, I genuinely think there are some very cool things in this. So like, as an example, I forget exactly what the phrase was, but he talks about how, oh, if you've been not paying attention to your text messages for a couple hours, maybe you're at a dinner, at a, you know, a kid's thing, you can say, catch me up. And it will use AI to hopefully do a good job of saying, you know, of the 907 text messages you just received, the key takeaways are you got to go to dinner in half an hour with your wife at such and such a location. And, you know, your kid wants to know if they can play more Minecraft or whatever the case may be. Like, that to me is cool. Or I think they've shown other examples
That would be cool if it worked. But yes. I like with any of these things, you're always like, okay, so what is the consequence if it doesn't quite work? Probably not that big for summarizing text messages, but like, are you going to rely on it? Like, what if it's something about when someone needs to be picked up or dropped off or stop off at the store and get something or whatever? And it either tells you something like that didn't exist or doesn't tell you about it when it does exist. And you getting back to the technology, making your life better, and you come home and your wife's like, what, did you forget to pick up Timmy? You're like, oh, I, what do you mean? It's like, I texted you. I said, you need to pick him up at the school. And it's like, oh, I asked my AI pin to catch me up and it didn't mention that. How do you think that's going to fly? And how is that going to make you?
What are you supposed to do after it summarizes your messages? Do you just delete them or do you read them later? Like,
I'm saying, is the summary useful? The summary is only useful to you if you believe it. And if you have any doubt, like maybe, like again, maybe you don't care. Maybe it's like, oh, I don't care. But I feel like it'll only take one of those things where you were supposed to pick up your kid and you didn't, and you have to explain why by saying that you asked for a summary from your pin, and your wife's going to say, well, never use that again, because obviously it doesn't work every time.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's not like it's not life or death. Like, oh, the kid's at school, you know, but like that type of thing. It's when you get on to stuff like interpersonal communication and ask me for a summary, it looks great in a demo. Like, look, it's saving me time. It's like having an executive assistant. But if your executive assistant forgot to mention you have to pick up your kid, you fire them. Like, you know what I mean? Or you have a talk with them at least. It's like, this is the job, right? Then the AI thing does it. You have no one to blame but yourself because you believed it. And it turns out that was consequential enough that now your hobby tinkering with this little thing versus how much benefit is it actually giving you in your life? Like, you love it when it comes together and you feel like you're in the future when it summarizes it, but that one time you forget to pick up your kid, you're never going to use that summary thing again. Or if you do, you're going to use a summary and then take out your phone to confirm and read every message. So what's the point of that?
Yeah. And if anything, like this, I think this just shows like the leaps and bounds they had to jump through to avoid having a screen just shows how good screens are. Like, if you see, like, the all the different ways this doesn't work, all the different conditions this doesn't work in, like, there's, like, somebody in the chat, David Shaw, and RepoMan27 just posted, the operating temperature range is only 41 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So, like, if you're in a really cold place or really hot place, like, nope, won't work.
Oh, my word.
What about...
Really cold is lower than 41? I guess you have to wear it inside your jacket if you live in any place that has winter.
Right. So you can't use it when you're outside wearing a jacket, really, because it's going to be covered up anyway. But even if you move it to the outside of your jacket every time you put your jacket on...
It's freeze solid.
It's going to freeze. On their own site, is AI pin waterproof? No, basically. It's a long answer.
It doesn't rain in California, so you're fine.
Right, so you can't use it if it's raining. Like, there are all these different conditions. It's like, okay, what if it was a screen in your pocket, like a phone? Well, it turns out those are really good, and you can use a screen that lives in your pocket or purse or bag or whatever. You can use that in so many more places and contexts and conditions than you can use something like this. And that's why it has no chance. Like, screens, even if people hated their phones, which they very much don't, but even if for some reason you could buy into the narrative that there's lots of people who want to spend less time on their phones out there, there aren't. But again, even if people hated their phones, the versatility of screens that are handheld, that fit in your pocket, and that you can pick up and take out in a split second whenever you want to, that versatility overpowers everything else here. That's like, you can't use the AI pin in the cold, in the hot, in the rain, when wearing a jacket, when wearing a light shirt, when somewhere where it would be visibly obtrusive or draw too much attention to you. You can't use it in a place where you can't use your voice. Maybe you are somewhere where you have to be quiet. In certain contexts where you have to be quiet. People have those all over their lives. Screens work in so many more places and contexts. And so while I understand, like, again, like I'm glad they're trying stuff. I'm glad people out there are making cool gadgets. It's fun. But don't bet against the smartphone, especially so directly against the smartphone. You will lose every time. Screens are awesome. There's a reason we have them. They projecting a laser screen onto your hand that you have to tilt and gesture in weird ways to use doesn't that's not better. Like when you see the laser screen, they blew it. Like that's
right. Yeah, you that's even on the rumply demo hand, it's like, oh, I see something on my hand. I can barely tell what anything is. The hand's too wrinkly and rumply. Yeah.
Yeah. Put a phone into that hand, then it's so much more useful.
Once you're looking at it. Yeah, the hardware problems like could be solved if the company had a good enough product that they could iterate on the technology and so on. But like, it feels like this entire product hinges on, as we pointed out last show, the thing that this company is not actually really making, which is the quote unquote AI part of it. And we all know that that part of it doesn't work as well as they would like. Imagine if you'd buy this thing for the same price and pay the same monthly fee, right? And every time you tapped it, it was like Amazon Mechanical Turk, and there was a person there who is your own human personal assistant. If you could get a human personal assistant to be on call 24 hours a day for $24 a month, that would be a great deal. And that is the dream of this. And you'd say, oh, but the hardware is bad, and it's not waterproof, and it's this, and it's that. I'd be like, no, $24 a month, and I tap this thing, and I can literally ask it to do anything, and it does it for me. Summarize my text messages, and it tells me, and it, you know, it's a person, so it gets it right. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a great product. And if they had that product, people would pay for it. And then the next version would be better. And the next version would be better. And you'd be like, I don't need to see anything on a screen. I just ask my little assistant and it tells me everything. Why do I need to see anything on a screen, right? I can whisper real low if I'm in a library and they can hear me because of these amazing microphones, right? But they don't have a human at the other end of that thing. They have, you know, whatever quote-unquote AI thing they're using, which is useful in lots of other contexts and may be useful in some of the contexts they want to use that, but not useful enough to make up for all their other failings. So they're never going to get to the point where they can iterate on this hardware, right? And, you know, again, they don't even really make the AI part of that. They're just piggybacking on a technology that other people are innovating. So I wouldn't trust this company to continue to push to the forefront of making that part smarter and better. Because that's not their core competency. Their core competency is apparently this idea of, you know, let's not be on screens as much and let's use a badge type thing. And the hardware that they've made and, you know, the software stack that it runs on. And the you know, the hubris to believe that, okay, the phone platforms that dominate our lives are so close that we can't build the product we want. So we're going to do it all ourselves. And I admire that. I admire the attempt to do that. It's one of the reasons I admire Lucid, because they did so much stuff themselves. But Lucid actually pulled it off, and this company, I think, has not.
Well, because Lucid was making something people want. Like,
yeah, but they did choose to do so many things themselves. Like, oh, you're going to make your own drivetrain? You're going to make your own? Like, why would you do that? We can do all the other EV companies did. I mean, instead, you're not just going to buy parts from somebody else and assemble them? Like, no, we're going to build all this stuff ourselves. It's like, well, that seems really hard. It is, and most companies can't do it, but the ones that do, it's very impressive. And this company, you know, Humane was forced to do this because they can't build on any of the platforms that it's natural for them to build on. So it's sad. It really, like, as much as I think this product is not, you know, going to do anything in the market, I wish that it was possible to make a good version of this product on any of the dominant platforms today that would be appropriate, you know, iPadOS, iOS, Android, right? But it's just not. Those companies don't. Yeah. If they don't want to make it, they don't want to let you make it, and that is the real shame of this.
Yeah, agreed. And again, like, I don't. This is a bad idea for so many reasons. Like your Lucid analogy, it's like if Lucid was like, hey, why don't you give up your car and switch to a hot air balloon? It's like, well, okay. I mean, that's going to be a tough sell for most people.
We would have made a car, but we're not allowed to be on the roads because the company that owns the roads won't let us. But we think hot air balloons are actually better than cars.
Yeah, you hate your car? How about something that's less capable and less convenient and you can operate in less conditions? Great. How about a hot air balloon? Oh, God. Anyway, but yeah, you're right. And it's ultimately like the inability for products like this to really have a fair shot is a tragedy of the modern tech, you know, lock-in ecosystem. And that's there's no telling how much innovation out there we could have today and that could be making our lives better and could be making the world better if not for Apple and Google's massive platform lock-in on their modern platforms that basically make it impossible.
Yeah, if anything, a company that had this idea could fail much faster because they wouldn't have to build everything, you know, all the operating system and platform stuff. They could just, you know, piggyback, build the, you know, you make an app on your phone and build a little bit of the hardware and have them integrated and just do the part that you care about. They can't do that because you can't get that kind of deep integration with iOS. But if they could, boy, they would save a lot of time and they would be able to come out with their product. And they would flop in the market because nobody wants it on the AI assistants that you don't, right? And it would save everybody a lot of money. But they had to build so much stuff and, you know, go this whole route of like, we are our own thing with our own phone number and our own operating system and our own lack of apps or whatever they were pitching. Like, we have experiences, not apps. It's like, you had to build all of that for what's probably going to turn out to be, if not a bad idea, then at the very least, an idea that is too ahead of its time because the tech is just not ready for it yet.
Yeah, they could have flopped in, you know, 6 weeks instead of 6 months. They're not going to make it safe. I'd be shocked if they ship.
They better ship this because I want to read reviews. I want to read them so bad.
You know, there's if you want to increase your odds, you could buy one. You know, they are taking pre-orders right now, and they don't appear to be sold out.
No,
yeah,
really?
They did let quote-unquote influencers see it, but they didn't give it to any tech reviewers, which is also not a good sign.
Well, and like there were the handful of, like, you know, New York Times, and like there were like a handful of outlets that got small like press experiences with it, and the articles, like, none of them are very complimentary about the product. Like, you know, they say it in nicer ways, but you could tell, like, none of them were impressed by whatever tiny amount of experience they got with it. Oh, poor people. I feel bad for all the people who worked on this, honestly, because, like, they had a lot of talent working on this, and it's just like, glad you tried it, but, oh, man, it's not going to work. All right, title.
Titles. I like Do You Have a Dragon? I like Very Confused Monks.
I have a question mark on that dragon thing.
Fair.
Azure Bucks is good.
Azure Bucks, yeah. No one ever said Azure Bucks, did they?
You did.
I thought you did. Yeah, I thought you did.
Did I say?
Yep.
I mean, a Chuck E. Cheese analogy. You got to buy tokens. You can redeem them for CPU time in Microsoft's data centers.
I like Get Back to Me About the Dragon. That's a good
one. I hope did I get that 10 billion number right? I said it many times in the
show.
I
believe that's correct, yes.
I mean, that's a lot of CPU time.
It really is.
But isn't it great that Microsoft, like, their investment was basically, you can use our stuff for free, which obviously, like, is that 10 billion retail? Like, because obviously it doesn't cost Microsoft.
Yeah, right.
10, but, you know,
of course,
so it's pretty
10 billion
good
retail.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's, you know, you're letting Microsoft has to pay for all that electricity and they had to pay for all that equipment. And like, it's not giving away money for free, but it's really cuts down the price of this. And now they can just get all the employees and the CEO and then good luck spending that $10 billion with your remaining, you know, 1/8 of your employees.
Well, if they need to waste a whole bunch of computing resources that they've got, and they don't know what to do with it, they can just turn to blockchain.
Yeah, I think that's a different group of kooks. Slightly different, maybe.
I suggested it, but I do like Get Back to Me About the Dragon. I also suggested and really like Very Confused Monks. I can do Azure Bucks. I like the other ones more.
I think Do You Have a Dragon with a question mark is my favorite.
I can do that too.
I'm fine with that. I think Azure Bucks is my number two.
All right, we'll do You Have a Dragon with a question.
Question mark?
Cool.
I'm Ron Burgundy. All right. Everyone, not just members. We are Monday again next week for reasons. So obviously we're recording on Monday tonight. We are recording again the Monday after Thanksgiving. And then subsequent to that, we'll probably have one episode where it's normal. And then God knows what will happen during holiday season. We haven't gotten that far yet. But
by the way, some real-time follow-up I didn't think was important enough to interrupt their main show with. How far back do you have to go in time before a 13-inch MacBook Pro is comparable in weight to the 16-inch MacBook Pro today? And the answer is 2011. The 2011, before the Retina ones. The one right before the Retina MacBook Pro, 13-inch, weighed 4.5 pounds.
I thought you were going to say the Air.
No, I think that was 3.0 at launch. I could be wrong. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so the 13-inch MacBook Pro pre-Retina was 4.5 pounds, and the 16-inch MacBook Pro is 4.8. So that's, I consider that pretty close.
Yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Not, it's not the weight that's the problem, it's the width and height.
Yeah, I agree with
it's
that.
It's just so,
yeah,
I mean, so are, darn big.
Yeah, of course, it is bigger, I'll give you that. But, like, it's not, like, there were so many years where we all carried 15 inches, except John, you always hated laptops. But, like, there were so many years when most of us nerds carried 15-inch laptops, and it was fine. Those were all these 5-pound big rectangle things.
See, this is what Vision Pro is really going to solve, because you always talk about, like, oh, so much nice time with all the screen space. Like, seriously? 16-inch screens? What century is this? Like, how about a Vision Pro where it's 11 feet tall and it's portable? Like, obviously you can't bring your big, but, like,
well,
I'm so used
is,
to having,
like, if it's still just this, like, 4K, you know, brought in screens, like, we're going to have the same problem as all those, like, non-retina gamer screens. Like, you can have
as big a monitor as you want
as long as it's 4K.
As technology advances, like the reason I always prefer the 14-inch is, like, honestly, 14-inch versus 16-inch, they both feel too small to me. They both feel small. And I get it. Yeah, of course, yes, they have to be small. So the whole point is it's a portable computer. But that's kind of like, you know, if the Vision Pro continues to evolve and stops being this gigantic, ridiculous thing, the promise of finally having a portable screen that is not too small is enticing.
Yeah, agreed.
And then you could have a laptop that is to get rid of that screen, get rid of the keyboard, get rid of all that stuff, and just have it to be like a little Mac Mini with better cooling that you carry around with you, and it projects onto your Vision Pro. Or heck, you know, you don't need all that stuff. Just have the Vision Pro. Anyway. Vision Pro as monitor is one of the areas that I'm most interested in, and actually it seems like the main thing that Apple is pitching it being used for, so we'll see. But yeah, like 16 inch is better than 14 inch in terms of screen real estate, but they just always feel too small for me. I have to compromise everything about how I work to fit myself into that size.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I get 16, like, because when I'm using it to do anything, you know, I'm going to be editing this podcast on it tomorrow, and I did it last week too. It's not fun editing a podcast on a 16-inch MacBook Pro when you are accustomed to a giant wall of XDR. But it always feels like I'm using a porthole.
Yeah, try using your Vision Pro.
Yeah, same thing with, like, you know, using Xcode. Like, when I'm accustomed to a huge monitor and you go to a tiny monitor of a laptop, it always feels very tiny. But every time I think, well, this feels tiny, but thank God I didn't get a smaller one.
All right, just Shrum,
scale the resolution and move your nose closer to the screen.
Oh my gosh, we have some stuff to discuss. So goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people. Thank you for being live people. We will see you next Monday, same usual time. Bye.